things work.
This is a test of the emergency broadcasting system.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yes. It's been an actual emergency. Blah, blah, blah.
No, why don't you wait until they actually got
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the City Council meeting, City of Arroyo Grande, for Tuesday, April 26th. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Dickens.
Here.
Councilmember Guthrie.
Here.
Councilmember Arnold.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello.
Here.
And Mayor Ferrara.
Here. Next in line is our flag salute. This evening, our flag salute will be led by Knights of Columbus. And if you will remain standing, our invocation this evening will be...
Entry. In this great state, in this great county, in this great city, and we just open ourselves to your guidance. We want to make decisions that we sense are guided by you. We pray these things in your name. Amen.
Well, Homer, before you rush off, I think you know the drill. We get to learn about Knights of Columbus and what you folks have been doing recently. So,
thank you, Mayor. My name is Homer Cleese, and I am the Grand Knight for the Arroyo Grande Knights of Columbus, Council 1375. We are a very active group here in Arroyo Grande, doing many activities, which I'll tell you a few in a moment. I'd like to let you know that we are the largest Catholic organization in the world that supports the Catholic Church. There's 1.7 million of us, and we're just a little bitty grain of sand in the whole thing. There's 170 members in the Knights of Columbus in Arroyo Grande and the environs, Grover Beach, Oceano, Napomo. That's where I live. Okay, just a few of the things that we've done. Each year we support the Alpha Gay organization. They are very involved with young women who are trying to keep their babies. And we support them by having an Alpha Game Hen dinner. This year, we're contributing $1,000. And during the year, we have a little game we play during our meetings. It's called Get Out of Line. It costs you money. And so we're also adding about $250 along with the thousands for the Alpha Club because some of the guys do get a little naughty or talkative. We assisted in cooking the corned beef and cabbage dinner for a fundraiser for the Catholic Church. We hosted a salad luncheon for the priests and office personnel of the church just recently, trying to let them know how much we appreciate all of their support. We've been attending the planning sessions for next year's Harvest Festival, along with Steve Adams, who is our leader. And we have upcoming in May the 28th and 29th, the Strawberry Festival. We're going to host a hamburger and chili booth. So if you're hungry, come see us. We'll take care of you during the Harvest Festival. I mean the Strawberry Festival. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Homer. It's good to have you here this evening. And Pastor Nelson, thanks again for the invocation, if you're still here. Okay, that takes us to item 5, special presentations. We have 2 this evening, and I will step down from the dais to present those. Howard Mankins. Howard, if you would come forward, please. You've been up here before to do this, but I have to tell you, this is about the nicest frame I think I've ever seen. So for those of you who don't know, we have a project ongoing here in the city of Arroyo Grande called was very kind and generous to give the city of Arroyo Grande an extremely generous donation And do you mind if I say how much it was?
12 lights.
12 lights.
No, I don't.
Okay. It was $36,000. And this is yet another indication of Howard's commitment to this community and to the goals of our city. And Howard, it's with great pleasure that I present this mayor's commendation in recognition of your generous contribution to the Village Streetlight Let There Be Lights program. And I would sure hope that you would say a few words. So it's a pleasure to present this to you.
I'm just a little bit embarrassed. We never gave anything this elaborate away when I was mayor, Tony. But it is beautiful, and thank you very much. I just might say that my wife runs the Briscoe's gift shop down here, and she's sort of the one who spurned the idea about maybe buying a light or two, and we looked at things, and we bought them all. On the street, that is. I just might say, if I might, Mr. Mayor and members of the council, that our family goes back a long time here. I do family research, and it's sort of one of those things that I think I'm glad I'm here, and the only reason I'm here is because of them. And it's my town, our family's town, and it's really nice to give something back when you can do it. Seems like that too many times we feel that the city is there for the taking instead of the giving. And I just briefly indicate that my dad's family came to this country in 1644. And fortunately, two young men came out to the Oregon Gold Rush in 1849. Gold not being the thing that they was told it was, they came down and one of them landed on this side of the valley and one landed over in the valley California Valley, and fortunately, my ancestor landed here, and so they came down at that particular time, and they've been here since. My mother's people came very early on, from what I can gather. Queen Anne of England rescued them from Germany, from being persecuted religiously, sent them to Holland because she didn't dare her married relatives who were part of the German family, and then she brought them down to from Denmark down to England and shipped them over, and they became indentured servants. And they left the escape from their farms, and only 35,000 of them came, and only half of them survived the first year. And our family sort of came from that. So we've been here a long time. They came out to California in 1876 and into Rio Grande. My father, my grandfather, and my great-grandfather on both sides. Well, I have a mother on the other side, but are buried in the Rio Grande Cemetery. So it's our town, it's our place, and we're very happy to be here and be able to participate. Thanks again, Mayor.
That a special day be set aside for the planting of trees. And whereas this holiday called Arbor Day was first observed with the planting of more than a million trees in Nebraska. And whereas 2005 is the 133rd anniversary of Arbor Day, and it is now observed throughout the nation and the world. And whereas trees can reduce the erosion of our precious topsoil by wind and water, cut heating and cooling costs, moderate the temperature, clean the air, produce life-giving oxygen, and provide habitat for wildlife. And whereas trees are a renewable resource, giving us paper, wood for our homes, fuel for our fires, and countless other wood products, increase property values, enhance the economic vitality of business areas, beautify our community, and trees, wherever and whenever they are planted, are a source of joy and spiritual renewal. And whereas the city of Rio Grande has been recognized as Tree City USA by the National Arbor Day Foundation for the 23rd consecutive year and desires to continue its tree planting ways. Now, therefore, be it resolved that I, Tony Ferrara, mayor of the city of Rio Grande, on behalf of the city council, do hereby recognize and proclaim April 29th as Arbor Day in the city of Rio Grande, and we urge all citizens to celebrate Arbor Day and to support efforts to care for our trees and woodlands and to support our communities, our city's community forestry program. So, Dan, it's a pleasure to present this to you. And if you'd like to say a few words, feel free.
Yes, I'd just like to state to the council and everyone here, thank you very much for the proclamation. We will be having an Arbor Day tree planting ceremony this Friday at 10 a.m. at Elm Street Community Park. Our department's very dedicated to tree planting and preservations. In the last 3 years alone, we've added over 350 trees to our city inventory. So we're pretty proud of the job we do. We can always do better, but hopefully we can encourage everyone to come out on Arbor Day this Friday, 10 a.m. at Elm Street Park. Thank you.
All right, that takes us to item 6, agenda review. Move that all resolutions and ordinances presented tonight be read in title only and all further readings be waived.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. That takes us to item 7, community comments and suggestions. Tonight we have a bit of a different structure for community comments and suggestions. This is a public comment period for members of the audience to come forward with thoughts, suggestions, recommendations on matters not scheduled on this agenda. Comments should be limited to those matters that are within the jurisdiction of the council. The Brown Act restricts the council from taking formal actions on matters not published on the agenda. Now, okay. I'm wondering, I think we're going to run this the same way. And what's sort of confusing this is the issue of the consent agenda. There are people here this evening that I'm under the impression want to comment on some consent items. To the council as a whole, and limit your comments to 3 minutes or less. Any member of the audience that would like to come forward? Please come up to the podium and state your name for the record.
Good evening, Mayor. Good evening, City Council. My name is Dennis Mann. I'm from Charlotte, North Carolina. So I'm a little far away from home tonight. And I'm here representing the family interests of Kristen Smart. And I assume that everybody here is very familiar with her. Is this any better? For those of you who do not know who Kristen Smart was, she was a Cal Poly freshman in 1996, and on the evening of May 25th, 1996, she disappeared. And 6 years later, the San Luis Obispo court declared Kristen legally deceased. The police have identified Paul Ruben Flores as the prime suspect in the case. And tonight, in attendance here, we have Paul's mother, Susan, and her boyfriend, Mike McConville. The reason why I'm here tonight is on May 25th of next month is going to be 9 years. And everybody in this room agrees that 9 years is just too long. There's not really anything specific the mayor or city council can do, but I just think it's important for Kristen's memory that her name be spoken in this chamber tonight. Kristen was born on February 20th, 1977. I spoke to mother. She was born in Germany. She came to the Central Coast because she insisted on it. Her mother and father said she loved this area. And one thing that really struck me, as frustrated and as angry as Stan and Denise Smart are, they believe that Kristen will ultimately be found. And I asked Mrs. Smart about 2 weeks ago, I said, when you get Kristen back and you have a nice Christian service for her, where are you going to bury her? And her answer stunned me. She told me that the Smarts are from Stockton, California. She said, Dennis, we're not going to live in Stockton forever. And Kristen loved this area. So they plan on burying Kristen somewhere around here. And it just speaks volumes that the Smarts are not angry at Arroyo Grande. They're very angry at the Flores family and the fact that they will not cooperate with investigators. In June of 2000, police got a search warrant to get on Susan Flores' property to look for Kristen or items belonging to her. They used ground-penetrating radar. The FBI told Mr. and Mrs. Smarts that there were some anomalies in the backyard, and so the results were inconclusive. A couple years after that, I was in San Luis Obispo, and I sat in Lieutenant Steve Bolt's office, the sheriff. He was the lead detective on the case. Nobody on this planet, except for the Flores family, know more about this case than Steve Bolt's. And he told me on that day when it came time, they took a vote whether or not they should dig up the backyard. And Steve Bolts voted in favor of it and that he was outvoted. So the reason why you see me around town right now with the sign that says dig up Susan Flores' backyard is I'm hoping that law enforcement can get a second search warrant. Now, remember, when you have a search warrant, law enforcement cannot arbitrarily go on people's property. They have to go to a judge and say, this is the information we have. This is why we believe it's whatever they show the judge signed off on it. The Flores do not like the fact that I'm in town, but I have a standing offer. It's been up there for years that if they will waive the Fifth Amendment and agree to cooperate with the San Luis Obispo Sheriff's Department, answer all of their questions to their satisfaction, then I will shut my website down, I'll shred that banner, and I'll go back to North Carolina the same night. So,
Honorable Mayor, members of the City Council, and city staff. First of all, I would like to thank our city's police department in protecting its citizens of Arroyo Grande. Many of you come to realize not only my home, but my places of work have become a target of harassment. The First Amendment gives people freedom of speech. However, it takes the court system to stop slanderous statements and untruths that can be said about you. In an attempt to inform the public the truth, I'm informing the public that the permits for the concrete in my backyard are from 1981 and are on file with the city of Arroyo Grande. For the record, our family purchased the home in 1988. As a final statement, it is also our family's hope that Kristen Smart will someday return to her family. It saddens us that lies are used to support a mission for a missing woman. Again, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Anyone else who would like to come forward? Items not published on the agenda, 3 minutes or less, please. No one? Okay. And we will close public comment. That takes us to item 8, the consent agenda. And I think at this point, rather than to pull individual items, the consent agenda has been published. So if there are members of the audience that would like to come forward and comment on individual items, please feel free to do so. Again, the same rules apply generally. Try and limit your comments to 3 minutes or less, and this would be an opportunity for you to come forward.
Good evening. Chuck Fellows, Canyon Way. Pardon me, Roy Grandy. I'm requesting that item 8I be pulled from tonight's consent agenda so that the idea of turning over some the care of some 380 trees to private property owners from the Parks and Rec Department to the private property owners can be made subject to higher public review. A number of us feel that our community, I guess you could call this a rebuttal to an earlier statement. A number of us in the community feel that our community is losing trees far faster than they are being replaced, especially street trees. That is to say that our tree ordinance is not resulting in adequate protection of our urban forest. I think that handing over the care of the trees in question in item 8I resolution to the property owners at this time before a thorough review and a public input may result in the loss or mutilation of many of them. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else would like to come forward?
Hello, my name's Mike Lebo, and I'm the Destination Imagination Coordinator for the Lucy Amar School District. And specifically, I'm talking about item 8F. And if you don't mind for a second, I'd like to reflect on two stories with two different kids. We had a young lady in seventh grade who was working with cars, and they had to manipulate cars over a course. And after having that experience in seventh grade, she found out that she could be an engineer. She applied to MIT, and she graduated in engineering. She attributed that success to that seventh grade moment. It's difficult. It's sort of like watering a plant without some sort of support. It just dies at the vine. And I think that financial support to the programs that are happening are what's keeping us whole. And we have a group of kids here right now, if you don't mind them standing, as part of our 3 minutes here. This is our Judkins kids, and if you don't mind stepping out, and I'll introduce the Ocean View kids in a second. Half of the...
You have some additional time, by the way. So.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
The Judkins kids here, half of them are from Arroyo Grande, I might add, and... When they walk into the World Finals, they finish first in the state, and they're representing the state of California, and they're an improvisational team, and they truly go by the word improvisation. They don't have any idea what they're going to do until they actually walk in the room, and they create and they invent, and they're absolutely brilliant. And I fight every way I can to keep kids like this engaged in activities that will keep them going and be successful. And when they walk into World Finals, this is their opening. Why don't you give them their opening?
5, 6, 7, 8.
It's an improv life for us. It's an improv life for us. Stand radio, we chose this. No scripts, spontaneous. It's an improv life.
It's an improv life.
It's an improv life.
Thank you.
And this group right here is from Ocean View, which is pure Arroyo Grande. And if the Arroyo Grande kids would like to stand up for a second and introduce yourself to the council, I think they have a little presentation too. Do you not? Yeah? Okay. Now, they did not do improv. This group had to invent something. I believe they did. Is serendipity, Maggie? Maggie? So they had to invent something that led to another invention. And they had to, it had to be original. And while you're not going to see the whole presentation, this is what they put together for you today, a special presentation for you.
Now you see why we sometimes make exceptions to the 3-minute rule. This is well worth it.
Cost about $24,000 to send our two teams. We asked for two.
Just ask that if any of those, it was unclear from the report that I saw whether any of those consent items would affect the ongoing issues over the responsibility for maintenance of the Berry Gardens drainage basin. And if so, if we could hold off until we have resolved some of those issues.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else?
Good evening, City Council. My name is John Mack, architect for S&S Homes. The item is 8G. It's regarding the boundary sewer connection service agreement between Arroyo Grande and Grover Beach. And it looks great. I had time to review the agreement. There's just a typo on the actual agreement language, and wanted to bring it to staff's attention. Under 1 on page 2, it notes that it's an agreement to allow Parkview Estates Phase 2 to tie into the sewer. It should be Phase 1. We're only looking to tie into 13 homes off of Dixon, not the 52. Thank you.
Thank you. Have you passed those corrections on in written form to staff, Mr. Mack?
No, I haven't. I just reviewed this tonight.
Okay, thanks. Anyone else? No one? Okay. We will close the public comment on the consent agenda and bring this back to the council. And based on the comments that we've heard, what is the will of the council specifically as to those items that were addressed this evening during the public comment?
Mr. Mayor, I'd like to poll item 8I. And I don't know, do we need to poll the G, or can we just make the correction without polling it?
We'll clarify when you make your motion that we're going to make that correction.
I would be my only one then. Thank you.
Okay. Any other items?
Mr. Mayor, it would be worth it just to double check on the request for 8H in regards to the ongoing issues with maintenance of the Berry Gardens drainage basin.
Okay. Any others? Okay, then if there are no others, I'll entertain a motion for approval of consent items 8A through 8L with the correction to 8G as noted, and with the exception of 8H and 8I.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Anything in there to read, Tim?
No, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? If not, roll call.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay. Request to poll 8H. Councilmember Dickens?
Yes, Mr. Mayor. I think it would be prudent to at least answer the question, and if Don's coming up, thank you, in regards to the acceptance of easements, right-of-ways, and public improvements for track 2260. The question has been may or may not affect the question at hand.
The item that we have this evening, which is the consideration of the acceptance of the easements and right-of-ways for the Berry Gardens tract, is for the standard items that we have for right-of-way for the public streets, the park, the sidewalks, and those sorts of things. It does not affect in any way the maintenance of the drainage basin that's adjacent to the Brambles development.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And 8I, Councilmember Arnold.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I think in light of what one of our planning commissioners has spoke of tonight and also the letter that we received from one of our ARC members, I think it would probably be prudent right now to postpone this item until we have a chance to have the joint ARC and the Rec and Parks Department joint meeting so they can maybe resolve some of the issues that have arisen from this proposal.
Okay. Is there any further discussion on 8I?
I have a couple of questions, if you'd be all right.
Go ahead.
380 trees was mentioned. I may have missed in the staff report. Is that an accurate number, the number of trees that are affected by this decision, that we're currently maintaining 380 trees on private property?
Approximately. There are no specific records.
Well, I'm not talking about necessarily. I understand there's no records on what we own, but certainly we know what we're working on.
380 trees.
Is what we're working
on. And they're
on.
Within, they're in different parts of the city. Some are in the residential, single-family residential, some are in commercial, some are in multifamily.
Could you give us an example of a fairly familiar one that we could all identify that we maintain on private property?
Well, the problem with the ordinance has been that you can go through just about any neighborhood and have four or five homes with a tree that the property owner maintains and come upon a fifth house, which is in the same location and the same setback that we maintain. And it's pretty much sporadic that way throughout the city. I think off the Greenwood, Cottonwood development, for example, one of the older neighborhoods, we have that instance in many situations over there where every other tree or every third tree belongs to a private property owner or belongs to the city maintains.
For instance, the trees that are along that are in the along the parkway, if you want to call it that, but along the sidewalk on Halcyon, are those trees that we'll continue to maintain? Or are those examples of trees on private property? The street trees.
The street trees on Halcyon, those are city trees.
Those
down by the
continue to maintain.
Yes, it doesn't affect any trees that we continue to own that we currently own now. We're just discussing trees that are planted on private property.
At some point, we we started taking responsibility for them and have continued to.
Yes, we have. Okay. And there's been...
Well, one thing we just wanted to hope to mention was that as far as some of the proposal to review the city's tree ordinance, possibly strengthen the tree ordinance, is something that we're very supportive of. We've actually started doing that. In May, you'll see the first results of that to some initial revisions. Staff would be happy to go back and do some research and come forward with some additional alternatives we may want to consider to strengthen the overall tree program. However, I don't think any of those efforts would impact this recommendation, which is really completely separate of other concerns regarding the tree ordinance.
If I can just piggyback onto that, this was an alarming issue when it first came up because most of us were unaware of the fact that we were maintaining trees on private property. There's sort of a fundamental misconception that when we plant a tree on someone else's property, it's still our tree. There are no agreements that would normally change that arrangement. When you plant something on property, it normally becomes a part of the property, and that's the case with all the trees that we planted. There was never any agreement or condition that sort of fleshed out what it is we were doing and how long we would do it. And as a result, from my perspective, when this was raised at the initial staff meeting, it had liability written all over it. We're accessing trees on private property that we don't own and maintaining them, and it raises a whole gamut of significant liability issues that the council should be aware of, from the access itself to the maintenance, the quality of maintenance, the consistency of the maintenance. And I think if the council does go ahead and adopt this, it'd be my recommendation, and I've discussed it with both Dan and Steve, that we take additional steps in terms of notifying property owners whose trees we have been maintaining in the past that we will not be maintaining them, that they are their trees to maintain, probably contacting the California Joint Powers Insurance Authority to let them know about the situation. It is a very unusual situation, and frankly, it is unrelated to the bigger issue of our tree ordinance and how we're going to modify and or maintain the procedures we have in place now. But I wanted to emphasize this somewhat unorthodox situation where the city planted – we don't have any records of exactly how, when, where, but we are maintaining trees on someone else's property that have significant liability issues associated with them.
Any other discussion?
So that is where the urgency is coming from more so, because that my first question was going to be, well, what is the urgency if we wait another month or so to try to resolve some of these other issues and maybe get a tree policy in place that's firmer than what we have right now? And this is the reason for the urgency is the liability?
No. That was my panic when I found out about the situation. The urgency came, I think, through Parks and Rec and more funding-related issues, our ability to continue to maintain trees that we do own in public right-of-ways and public parks, as opposed to some trees on private property. And the records on the issue are so spotty that it's really not clear, at least unless Dan can lend a little bit more to this, why we targeted certain trees and why not others. I'm alarmed from a liability standpoint, but I don't think that's why this appeared on your agenda. It appeared separate from legal issues.
And as far as urgency, I think it's an urgent situation in terms of it's something we need to address fairly quickly, whether it has to, it's gone on for quite a long time, whether it has to be done tonight. I don't think there's that type of urgent situation. I think the point I wanted to make, though, is the requests that have been made in terms of issues that citizens would like to have looked at, we're fully supportive of that and would like to help facilitate that. But I don't think it should warrant holding this up because I think they're two separate issues. I mean, none of those discussions would impact our concern over how this particular issue is currently being handled.
So. Right now, if a city-maintained tree were to be...
Health raises a lot of very serious issues. It better be done well, because if you do it wrong and there are problems with the trees, if there are safety issues related to it on private property, the city's sort of stepping in to lend a helping hand that we never intended to do, and I think we need to curtail that as soon as possible. But that's unrelated to the reason why it got here, which I think was more just a maintenance, trying to balance out various competing interests, city fund interests.
Mr. Mayor, I withdraw my withdrawal.
Okay, so I understand that you do not want to pull 8I for further?
Well, I don't want to postpone it. I think the reason for doing it was to protect the trees, and right now the trees have no additional protection from this ordinance, and actually the city has more liability, so I'd be inclined to go ahead and accept 8I as proposed.
Okay. Any other discussion on 8I?
Mr. Mayor, I just had a quick question for Dan, if I may. Dan, I think that some of the concern would be that this has been an ongoing practice, and that if we were to automatically just stop doing the maintenance, that the potential could then be that the folks that were relying upon this would just arbitrarily say, well, shoot, I'm not going to do it, and we may end up jeopardizing, some nice trees. And I think that would be the fear, I guess. And so I guess my comment to you would be that this has probably been a practice that, for instance, if I were to ask you how many trees are out there, you may not even be, you could probably do an inventory. It'd take a while, but it's because we've had staff for so long that have done a great job. They've kind of, I'm assuming, taken on some of these responsibilities. They're the ones who knows where these trees are at. Do we get calls from these folks saying, hey, it's annual time to get out here? Is that how it sparks up? Or is it just your staff kind of just has routinely done this and they continue to do it?
We've gone through, for example, we have trees that are leaning over in the streets and we have street clearing issues. Basically, Public Works will go by in coordination with our staff. We'll find certain trees that the property owners are responsible for. However, with the current practice, the ones that have owned the trees have said, well, the city's taking care of it over this period of time and we're kind of stuck doing it. We've also had situations where there's been significant damage to people's private property from some trees that they've had that are city-owned, for example, pushing up sidewalks, damaging driveways, and cracking foundations. And they're coming to us requesting that, well, it's your tree, you need to fix it. And those are the issues we're trying to get away from.
And I guess my bottom line would be, in your opinion, if we were to move forward with this tonight, are we going to see chainsaws getting out there tomorrow?
I highly doubt it. I highly doubt it. Most of these people, you know, they like their trees in their yards.
I mean, I think we need to identify that could be possible in some. We don't expect a whole rash of that, but there may be instances where we've worked with folks to try to keep the tree, and if we were no longer involved, there might be some. I mean, I think we have to be honest, there could be some of those instances, but we don't expect them to be a lot.
So are we out of the permit business now as well?
No, the permits still apply for all trees in multifamily, residential, and commercial consistent to the code we have in place now. So any of the trees that are in those areas that would still need to be permitted for removal.
Placing much more emphasis on preservation of the tree. And so what we're doing in May is coming back with some code changes that reflects that in the code in terms of what our current guidelines are for determining when a tree has to be removed versus trimmed.
We're going to be going to the Parks and Recreation Commission probably next month and start to review some additional language for possible adoption by the council.
Yeah, and again, based on recent activity, I think it's a topic that we really do need to clarify.
Definitely.
Okay, with that, I'll entertain a motion for approval of consent items 8H and 8I.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, I believe we have a resolution in there. In fact, we have two of them, I think.
Item 8H is a resolution of the City Council of the City of Rio Grande accepting certain easements, rights of way, and related improvements within Track 2260. There's actually two resolutions within this item, I believe. The second is a resolution accepting certain resolution of the City Council of the City of Rio Grande accepting certain easements, rights of way, and related improvements off-site of Track 2260. And then the final is a resolution of the City Council of the City of Rio Grande ceasing city maintenance of trees planted by the city on private property.
Okay, thank you. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none.
I think one piece. I think staff would be, as you mentioned, Steve, in conjunction with the trees that are on private property, we do want to notify the property owners involved that they need to start maintaining the trees.
I'm glad to do that. Also, would you like, there were some suggestions here on a joint meeting with some of the commissions. I was going to suggest, we'd be glad to do that, or I was going to suggest as an alternative, staff go ahead and draft some alternatives for changing and reinforcing and strengthening our tree ordinance, and then bring those individually to the different commissions and then to the council and get their recommendations on that. That might be a way to bring it forward a little quicker, but... I'm open to suggestions and direction on that.
Why don't you, I guess my recommendation would be, why don't we talk to Parks and Rec and ARC or whoever else is involved and see how they want to do it, if that's acceptable. And I like the idea anyway of coming forth with a starting point. And so if staff wants to go ahead and present something as a starting point for discussion, that would be beneficial. Anyone else have a comment on that?
I tend to agree. Whatever the fastest method would be, and putting together a joint meeting with what would be four commissions is not going to be the fastest way.
Yeah. Okay. Any other discussion? We have a motion and a second. Roll call, please.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
Mayor, members of the council, the staff report indicates that there have been technical studies related to the original design concept of the Parkside and Parkview development located on 10.3 acres on the north side of Farrell Avenue between Oak Park and Golden West Homes. One of the conditions of approval of the tract map outlined in resolution number 3726 as condition number 114, anticipated that the retention and retardation basin, which also functions as a neighborhood park, would be designed subject to the approval of the Director of Public Works and conceptually hold twice the drainage capacity as that which would be needed for the project itself. Due to the technical constraints of the adjacent ponding basins and overflow basin, basins 2 and 3 in the Soto Sports Complex, it has been determined that there is a capacity constraint to the on-site basin that was proposed. There are a variety of alternatives, including basically a project redesign or requiring a homeowners association to maintain a private park and ponding basin. The alternative that the staff recommends and has tentatively negotiated is that the developer contribute to the public drainage facility improvements on the Soto Sports Complex. This would include additional sump pump and facilities that would enable basins 2 and 3 to discharge into either the bleeder line that connects to Arroyo Grande Creek or to pump water back into Basin 2 to reduce the amount of time that the sport field would be inundated, which can contribute to damage of the turf. A contribution was calculated, and the estimated improvements were less than the contribution that was volunteered, which is $150,000. This requires modification of the condition. There is a concern in terms of the maintenance of that, which is outlined as condition number 15, related to the park ponding basin. And because maintenance districts can be a future concern if dissolved, this provision would provide for the developer to be responsible in the event of a maintenance district being formed and dissolved or not formed, that the applicant would have to return to one of the alternatives, such as the homeowners association. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and respond. Don Spagnuolo, the Public Works Director, might explain more detail the drainage alternatives available.
Did you want to add something, Don, or no? Okay.
No, I'm just here to answer questions.
Questions on the staff report?
I would basically say that the proposed alternative is probably superior in terms of capacity to preventing inundation of the Basin 3 and enabling pumping from Basin 2 as well. The bleeder line serves the entire drainage zone A. Originally, drainage zone A was calculated to be adequate for the entire southwest portion of the city. In subsequent analysis, it was determined to be deficient. The on-site basin that is being provided to Parkside and Parkview is totally adequate to meet the 100-year storm calculations of the project and provide additional relief capacity to the city's drainage zones, but not twice the capacity. And that's the reason that a monetary contribution was made to offset the loss of twice the capacity.
Can I just add, neither the original proposal or the revised proposal were really designed to address the entire problem. They were both designed. They both been designed to help assist addressing the problem, and will make a significant contribution to expanding the capacity there. But there will still be some issues there that we'll need to work on through other means in the future.
But the proposal before us today is actually superior to the original. Okay. And in terms of the benefit maintenance assessment district, who's going to be involved in that?
Tract itself, 73 homes, the 13 single-family homes in Phase 1 and the 60 homes in Phase 2 would constitute the new maintenance district, and it would have, in addition to the park ponding basin, other landscape parkways and areas to maintain. Yes, it is a city operated maintenance district. We have an adjoining maintenance district in the Dixon tract that maintains landscape improvements, and those homeowners association, or excuse me, the homeowners contributions to the maintenance district fund the city's hiring a property manager and maintenance company.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Councilmember Arnold?
Yes. When we were doing this initially, there was some discussion as to the fact that the city was going to be getting extra capacity, and I thought we were going to give something to S&S in exchange for that. Was there ever anything that was exchanged or not?
I think that the concern was the benefit to the tract in terms of the basin providing primarily drainage capacity for the tract itself, so it's a benefit district. That could have been maintained by a private homeowners association. S&S, as the developer, preferred not to create a homeowners association, but a maintenance district was an alternative that was discussed in the original approval. So the city agreed to accept the basin for its public benefit of increased capacity to drainage beyond the tract, and also the public benefit of
prepare and adopt the maintenance district's formation documents. And I believe that in our document, that's S&S's responsibility. Is that correct?
That is correct. This was a preliminary letter negotiating terms and conditions, and was superseded by the final resolution.
And then in the item 5, it also mentions reduce the park improvement fees by the actual cost of all park and walkway improvements installed. Those walkways would not include sidewalks in the actual subdivision. It would just be any walkways that was connecting the park to Soto. Okay. All right. That's all. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Councilmember Dickens.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I just had a curiosity question, Don. We're talking about the bleeder line discharge to Arroyo Grande Creek. Could you identify where that bleeder line goes? Would it leave Soto And where does it connect into the creek? I'm just curious.
It doesn't actually connect into the creek. It goes from the Pontoo, travels through Elm Street Park. It connects up to Fair Oaks, travels down Fair Oaks to Halcyon, hooks a left, and ends up in a catch basin that's right there close to the Corinth, directly across the street from the hospital. So there's a catch basin on the other side. There's a catch basin on the hospital side. There's a huge 48-inch pipe that connects the two. And then there's a 48-inch pipe that goes through the hospital site that connects up to Arroyo Grande Creek.
Okay. Interesting. Thank you. And I just had a follow-up in regards to the same thing that Councilmember Arnold was talking about. And then the agreement that's before us this evening, is that something that the applicant, S&S Homes, is agreeable to? And maybe they can speak to that themselves, but because it is a little bit different than the letter of April 12th.
We did provide them with a copy of the conditions, which they expressed support for. The difference in the letters is just, I think it's a little bit of semantics. The city does form the district, but we're requiring them to cover the costs and provide the reports required to set that up. So their letter was technically accurate. There's just a little bit of difference in the steps involved in actually doing that.
And then the last thing is just some clarification. I know when this came before us, there is actually an existing drainage basin, I believe, next to this property. Is that correct?
There is a small, detention basin that's right across, that's right adjacent to Farrell, yeah.
And that at one time we were, I know that's not part of this project. It's not their property. It's actually but it was totally underutilized. And I think there's some maintenance issues. What is the long-term aspect of that particular drainage basin as it relates to what we're doing this evening, or is there any? Is it just going to continue to stay there?
It's going to continue to stay there, and at such time that the owner of the property wants to do something other than a drainage basin, that they're able to do that.
Okay. Okay.
Just one question. Is my remembrance from Planning Commission that actually that is no longer a drainage basin, that in fact the...
They worked out the final designs of all the piping, but I don't think it's going to drain back into Basin 2, which is our main basin. I think it's going to be allowed to overflow into Basin 3, which is the sports field, in the event that occurs.
So it's a true retention basin, in that it's expected way to drain is actually going to be through the ground.
That's right. That's correct.
Okay. And so we haven't really worked out the shape of that. Is it going to be take up the entire piece of land? It's going to be 4 feet deep. None of that's actually been worked out yet.
Yeah, we've got some preliminary designs, but we haven't finalized the actual dimensions of the basin itself.
Okay. All right. Those are my only questions. Thanks.
Any others? Don, I need to clarify one thing. I was trying to do a visual as you were describing the circuitous route from that ultimately impacted to some degree Arroyo Grande Creek.
Mm-hmm.
Just for clarification, worst case scenario, high water flow, height of the rainy season, is there either a direct or diffused impact on Arroyo Grande Creek from this project as it makes its way through the system that you described?
None that I know of. I mean, we've never had a problem with that, and we don't anticipate having a problem with that.
Okay, thanks. Any others? Questions? Okay, this is a public hearing. If there are members of the audience would like to come forward and comment on 9A, this would be an opportunity for you to do so. No one? Okay, if you could come forward and state your name for the record.
Hi, my name's Dan Miller, and I actually maybe have some questions more than comments. As far as that small ponding basin you guys are talking about, there's a for sale sign hanging on the fence for $300,000 or best offer for somebody to develop a home there. So as far as I know, that's for sale. As far as questions, I've been to a couple of the planning commission meetings and council meetings just following this because I live on Golden West, and so I have an interest in that. It's pretty much my backyard that's being developed. Last I heard it was 67 homes, and I heard somebody tonight say 73 homes. Has the plan changed since the last meeting I was at? Or it seems to grow.
Can you respond quickly to that, Rob?
I would prefer if John Mack is present, he can clarify the final plan. I believe it was.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and finish your presentation, and then.
And the other concern I had was originally the plans that I saw had a park and a ponding basin separately. And I guess my concern would be how many months of the year will we be able to use this park? Because I know a lot of the ponding basins in Grover Beach in the area are full of water and they're squishy, and 6-8 months of the year you can't even go there. So what good does it do anybody to have a park that can't be used by anybody?
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Maybe we'll get an answer or two here.
Good evening, Mayor and City Council. John Mack again. Architect for S&S Homes. I think originally the project was proposed at 73-75 homes, but what was ultimately approved was 52 patio homes. And then too much was the other condition that we're looking to be modified, and it all has to do with the timing of the maintenance agreement. You can't have a maintenance agreement completed and formed until you have the book and page number after you record, so we can't put that in the agreement, so we don't have an agreement until we have a final map. So just for clarification on that. And it is our understanding and working with staff, because we worked many months on the solution, that this line is a superior solution to just holding more water. And after the engineers that were involved demonstrated that, it was real clear that it's going to be a tremendous benefit to the city. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments on 9A?
Hi, Colleen Martin. I was discouraged to see how many houses you're going to put there. And I'm wondering if in the process of this, you're planning to resurface Farrell, because people that live there are going to drive down Farrell to Halcyon, and they're never going to be able to make a left-hand turn at Harlow to get to the freeway, because what they're going to do is they're going to go from Halcyon, turn a right at Fair Oaks at the hospital, take Fair Oaks to Traffic Way if they're heading south, because that's the easiest way, just like the pig farm people do. That's how they get to the freeway going south. Farrell is in desperate need of resurfacing, and perhaps it would be wise for the city to not do that until after this project is done, as all the trucks that will be visiting this site to build all these homes will only further deteriorate the road. So we might as well wait till after it's further deteriorated to fix it. The other concern I have is from Halcyon to the project on Farrell, you still don't have sidewalks continuously. You don't even have sidewalks at the corner of Alder and Farrell across the street from a school site. So when we're building new homes, 73, 65, 45, whatever it is on that 10-acre site, I think that we need to look again at how far we ask the developer of the city to combine their efforts to put in sidewalks, curbs, and gutters along that, which will help with the drainage, because the drainage is pretty bad along Farrell, i.e. that's part of the reason the road's deteriorated so much. So I ask you to look at that, and also probably long time down the road should have been looked, I'm sure it was looked at before, turning left at Farrell, those cars are going to go down Farrell to Halcyon. I live off Halcyon. In 10 years, I can barely make a left anymore. The amount of traffic coming down Halcyon from the Mesa has made it very difficult. And that's just going to be 2.5 cars per home, 65 homes, another 130 cars coming down Farrell, like Councilman Guthrie does. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else would like to come forward? 9A. Okay, no one. We'll close public comment on 9A and bring this back for discussion and action for the council. Councilmember Guthrie, why don't you start this one for us?
Yeah, I am fairly familiar with this, of course, because we reviewed it at Planning Commission. I do think that the actual change we're talking about tonight, I had quite a long discussion with Don about it to understand exactly why this is a better solution or ability of the developer here. Those are certainly something the city should be looking forward to doing when we have some extra cash available. So I'm happy with tonight's action. I do, in fact, think that this will protect the baseball diamonds, except in the very biggest storms. I think we're moving in the right direction here, that we're going to come up with a mechanical rather than a static solution to our drainage problems over in that section of town. So I'm comfortable with what we're doing tonight.
Thank you. Extra cash available? Did I hear you say that?
That's right.
Okay. Just want to make sure. Councilmember Dickens.
Mr. Mayor, thank you. If I could have staff just respond, I believe that we've discussed Farrell Road, and Farrell Road is certainly one of the top streets within the city of Arroyo Grande that's been identified as in dire need of some serious work. So, if you don't mind just letting us know and the public know where we're at with Farrell.
Yeah, both staff and the city council have identified that as a top priority. So within the capital improvement program that will be presented on May 18th at the budget study session, it does include funding, proposed funding, in fiscal year 05-06, the next fiscal year for Farrell Avenue construction. Pardon me.
Steve, Steve or Don, if you could comment in regards to the fact that if that were approved, of course that's still speculative at this point, but if it were approved and we did move forward, would it be your desire then to do that after these homes were put in? Then is that sound reasonable?
I think so. I mean, we would want to let the construction traffic go by, and then any other equipment that they needed to get in there, and then we would come in once they've, because they're going to actually pave out the center line in front of their property in front of this housing development. Then we'll come in and make all the rest of it look nice and shiny and black.
And the other comment that Mr. Mack brought up in regards to the timing, and I believe that issue is actually addressed in here. So I think we're okay there. Okay. Other than that, we're not here looking at the entire project. The project's been approved. We're looking at just the amendment in regards to the original conditions of approval that would allow for us to redesign the basin. And I think that that's extremely appropriate. I think that the public's interest is certainly being looked at in regards to the benefits. And so I don't have any issues with what's been presented. And it looks like we should be able to move forward with this.
Okay. Thank you. Councilmember Arnold.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I, too, can go along with this. I think it's been covered pretty well that we have looked at the Farrell Road issue, and also we are not approving this project. This project is an approved project. We're just amending one of the conditions, and it appears for a superior condition. So I, too, can support this. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Not much more to say. I agree with my colleagues. It's gratifying to hear that Farrell is in the queue, subject to our approval in the upcoming budget. And I do think it's prudent to wait until this project is in so that we don't rip up a brand-new set of improved roads. And the provision we're approving tonight is...
I would term that or describe it as extreme. And if we're going to wait, which I think is a good idea, there's no sense in going in and resurfacing when we are going to have construction traffic. But, Don, this is one location that is going to require some careful monitoring, because we're not just talking about rough pavement here. We're talking about substantial potholes and divots in the pavement that could, in fact, cause damage to vehicles. So that's about as extreme as you get. So in terms of patchwork, until we're able to go in with a capital improvement project, that's one area that I think maybe the street crews need to monitor on a regular basis. We'll get a bit of a respite, I think, now that the rainy season has hopefully passed. So, but still in all, I think that needs to be jotted down on a kind of daily monitoring. And then I would also echo other comments that if this project presents an opportunity for us to connect the dots in terms of looking at a contiguous sidewalk pattern in any area in and around the school and the project, we ought to take advantage of it while that whole issue and area is unwrapped. So if there's some way that we can accommodate that, that would be beneficial. So those are my comments. Other than that, support staff's recommendation. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Mayor, I'll make a motion of the City Council to adopt a resolution of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande revising condition of approval number 114 regarding drainage basin for vesting tentative tract map 02-002 VTTM 2310 by S&S Homes, north side of Farrell Avenue.
We have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion on this item? Hearing none, roll call, please.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. Thank you. That takes us to item 9B, consideration of specific plan amendment 03-001. Applicant S&S Homes. Location is southwest corner of Cortland and East Grand Avenue. And for the record, this is an item that I'm going to have to step down on. My residence is within 500 feet of this project location. So I will turn this item over to Mayor Pro Tem and step down.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I see Ryan, you're up for the presentation.
Yes. Good evening, members of the City Council. This item is a proposed amendment to the Berry Gardens specific plan, specifically related to sub-areas 3 and 4 of the Berry Gardens area. Just to go over for review, kind of the purpose of a specific plan, why we have it. It is a planning tool that's provided for in state law. It's used to complement the general plan, but in a specific geographic area. It is used to coordinate public and private efforts and development of a particular area. And it can include and often does include multiple properties and multiple owners within one planned area. Project is located on the southwest corner of East Grand Avenue and Cortland Street. It's adjacent to Long's and across the street from the Sandals two sub-areas. Originally, it was anticipated to be retail commercial. At the time, that whole area was zoned general commercial. There was a portion of sub-area 3, which is approximately 1.6 acres, that was approved and subdivided with 9 single-family homes to continue the residential development on that portion of the site. Each sub-area 3 and 4 are owned individually. Sub-area 3 is currently for sale, and this application tonight is being driven by the owners of sub-area 4 who are pursuing development of their sub-area. We haven't really gotten to the point of property owner consensus on what's proposed. We've been working for quite a while. Just to go over a brief timeline, the amendment was first applied for in 2003. It was finally deemed complete in July of last year. It went to, I think, a total of 3 Planning Commission hearings, 2 in October, 1 in April of this, earlier this month, where it was approved by the Planning Commission. At that time, at the meeting in April, the representatives for sub-area 3 did request a 90-day continuance to further analyze the plan and maybe offer up some revisions to what was proposed. The Planning Commission, however, did deny this continuance request, citing that the addition of 90 days doesn't guarantee a resolution to the differences between the property owners regarding how the plan's going to work, and also that there's opportunity for future amendment actually by either party should this be approved. Purpose of the amendment is basically establishes a mini development code for the 6-acre site, including distribution of land uses, circulation, infrastructure improvements. It's not, however, an entitlement. Once the amendment is approved, any development would be subject to further discretionary review through conditional use permit or other applicable permit. However, anything that does come forward would have to be based on the development standards, which would be a part of the amended specific plan. Moving into the proposed amendment, it contains 2 land uses which separate out a multifamily apartment zone on the rear portion of each sub-area, approximately 2.6 acres, and also a mixed-use zone on the front portion, which is about 3.5 acres total. Just to run through some standards, includes lot size, coverage. There is a 45% 45-foot building height proposed for the mixed-use zone, which I'll describe in depth here in a little while. It does include 40,000-square-foot lot size with preclusion of subdivision for the multifamily apartment area, and that was something that came from Planning Commission review previously. Getting into the height a little bit, as I said, it's proposed to be maximum 45%. However, the portion above 35 feet would be limited to 25% of the floor area directly below that portion and also must be set back from the exterior edge of the floor below. So this would allow a greater height, but also reduce the massing and visual appearance of the building by stepping it back from the edges. And the idea is that at no point, on no plane of the building, is the wall taller than 35 feet continuously. Included in the concept plan as part of the specific plan amendment, it shows subarea 3 with a total of 20,000 square foot retail commercial space with 80 on-site parking spaces. Subarea 4 has a 3,600 square foot restaurant, 20,000 description. Basically, we took the 6 acres that were proposed to be retail commercial, subtracted a portion of that commercial, and added in 56 dwelling units. Doing this and recalculating all of the impact thresholds that were identified in the certified EIR, there were no significant impacts to those thresholds based on the changed project description. It has been discussed throughout the process allowing a higher intensity of use than the 56 dwelling units, and staff would be supportive of this. 25 dwelling units per acre on the multifamily apartment would be consistent with the general plan land use. It is designated, the entire area is designated as mixed use in the general plan. We would also support 12 units an acre in the mixed use area. This isn't the full 25% to keep the focus on retail, commercial, and office uses, as this is the main commercial corridor to the city. However, in light of potential environmental impacts beyond the scope of what was identified, this increase in density would require a plan amendment with appropriate environmental review. Just to identify some staff concerns with the proposed amendment, we did want to secure some kind of provision for access of subarea 3, which is basically landlocked aside from its access to Grand Avenue, and allow that to have some kind of access to Cortland, not only for vehicular traffic, but also for placement of easements. We did want to make sure that one of the driveways to the project aligned with Long's across the street, and also felt that it was important to make sure that infrastructure was provided prior to development of both sites. And as I said, this, we felt this was, there was a need to ensure coordination given the lack of agreement between the property owners on the plan itself. Again, easements and infrastructure, we felt that it's easier to deal with in a specific plan than to just let it piecemeal come in and then try to deal with it on a conditional use permit basis. Just run through some possible consequences if there's not coordinated development through the specific plan process. We could end up with 2 driveways on East Grand Avenue and no interior circulation, which would be contrary to what's stated in the East Grand Avenue Enhancement Plan. And also the drainage for subarea 3, as proposed, would go into the Poplar Street ponding basin. Without an easement, it would be very difficult to get there, and there may be the possibility to retain water on site for subarea 3. So just going over the staff solution to these problems that I've identified, and just to reiterate that the specific plan is considered a legislative action. The city cannot condition one property owner to just provide either land or improvements for the benefit of another property owner without any kind of compensation. Compare that to like a subdivision where we could put roads in or the like. So we came up with a reimbursement provision written into the plan. As part of the process coming through the specific plan amendment, in I believe it was December, both parties agreed to have an appraisal for the three easement locations. That was done. There was also a third-party analysis done for the required infrastructure improvements. Basically, the easement cost came out to $54,000 each, or $162,000 total for the three. And there's some mutually beneficial infrastructure improvements that would be a shared cost for each property owner of $152,910. Basically, puts a limit on up to three access easements. It may be that the three aren't required based on if subarea three comes back and amends the plan. There may be a way to get around having all three of those easement locations. Moving on to the recommendation, staff recommends that the City Council, actually Planning Commission recommends that the City Council adopt the resolution with the findings as outlined in the staff report and adopt specific plan amendment 03001. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them at this time.
Thank you, Ryan. Are there any questions? Councilman Dickens, why don't you go ahead and start.
Thank you. No, I don't. Ryan, I need some clarification on the issues that you presented. First of all, I still am a little unclear as to the 45-foot maximum building height. Where does that number come from in regards to the development code, and how does it relate specifically to this amendment?
Most of the development standards in the code are based on the standards for the Gateway Mixed-Use Zoning District. The 45-foot height was brought forward by the applicant, S&S Homes, along with the provisions that specify the setback and maximum floor area of that portion over 35 feet. The specific plan, as I said, it kind of is a miniature development code for this site, so it does allow flexibility beyond citywide zoning standards, but at this time, it's just a proposal by the applicant, and that's where it came from.
What is the we have a gateway section overlay, I believe. What is the building height of our gateway section at this time in our development code?
35 feet.
35 feet. So I'm a little unclear as to what staff is recommending, the 45 foot. What is the advantage to that?
I believe.
Why are we going outside the gateway standards for this particular amendment?
As I said, the specific plan amendment allows us to go beyond normal development code standards. There is a existing slope to the site, mid portion of the site. It slopes down into what would be the residential portion, and I believe it's the applicant's intent to build where their office building is shown on the concept plan. That's where the 45-foot request came from, and it would basically take advantage of the slope. There would be underground parking of the office. It would step up, appear to be three stories from Grand Avenue, four stories from the residential side. However, that additional element on top would be pushed back 20 feet from that side to minimize the visual appearance to anybody on that side of the project. I'm sure the applicant, S&S, can explain it in greater detail. But it's also, I believe it's mainly an architectural feature of the building. I think they described it as a mezzanine level to just add some architectural detailing and additional features to the site.
In staff's opinion, then, what's the advantage? Could not the applicant propose exactly what you're talking about further down the road once a specific development is coming forth? Could they not ask for an amendment at that particular time?
There's always the possibility of an applicant either stage, because they have a pretty clear idea of what they want to pursue down the road as far as development.
Okay, but we're not here looking at the concept plan tonight, is that correct?
We're looking at the concept plan as it pertains to the proposed specific plan amendment. But like I said, that's based on the proposed development standards. It's not necessarily when they come in for a CUP, we're not going to necessarily say, well, your building pad has to be exactly where it shows in this concept plan. That's just to illustrate mainly where the easements are going to line up for interior circulation and a distribution of buildings and parking.
I would add that the applicant has been ready and intends to submit the conditional use permit application immediately. The architectural design of the building has been presented to the ARC. and also to the Planning Commission. So it is evident that they are prepared to implement that portion of the specific plan, and this is a very timely adoption.
The second question I have deals with the maximum density, and you said that there was some clarification in your report, Ryan, in regards to the staff report that was presented to us. Currently, we're talking about a proposed specific plan amendment for both sub areas, and according to the staff report that was given to us, which could accommodate up to a total of 107 dwelling units. Yet that's not what, I mean, and I understand that's not what's being proposed in the concept plan. Is that still true, that the with the proposed amendment as presented, the maximum density could be 107 units, dwelling units?
No, it should reflect 56 dwelling units as proposed, with the opportunity to amend the specific plan amendment perhaps to a maximum of 107. And that was done. The original proposal was 56 dwelling units when it came in. Throughout the process of going to the commission meetings, the owner of subarea 3 expressed a concern that perhaps she would want to put more density on her subarea. So we started looking at what could be the maximum density, but then realizing that, like I said, when we started the process, it was 56. That's what the addendum was based on. And anything beyond that's going to go beyond the scope of the addendum and require further environmental review. So that distinction should be made that theoretically there would be potential for beyond 56 units, but it would require an amendment. Staff would be supportive of that amendment and also perform adequate environmental review at the time that any amendment is proposed.
So let's take the maximum 65 units that's being added to the entire Berry Garden specific plan. There was an initial EIR conducted and certified, and with the additional 65 units that we have the maximum being proposed at this particular time, it's staff's understanding or belief that that would not trigger an additional traffic study for that particular area? And that's based on the loss of retail with the addition of the new
taking units. Some away and adding some to it. It's a combination. And the combination works that it adding the residential component overall does decrease traffic, but it does increase the AM peak hour trips because you have people leaving for work. Whereas those AM peak hour trips wouldn't necessarily be there for strictly retail commercial use.
Mayor Pro Tem, thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
Just a quick follow-up on the 45-foot building here. And I understand, first, it's unique just to this site. You couldn't go down Grand Avenue and expect to do the same thing. It would be another specific plan review or at least plot plan review.
Well, outside of the two sub-areas, it would be their development code amendment or a variance.
Okay. Yeah. And as far as placement of a 45-foot building, could subarea 3 or subarea 4, whichever one, propose to put a similar 45-foot building on Grand Avenue and it be entitled by this? Or is there language here that basically says it has to be back on the lot, which is, you know, in the middle of the lot here?
There's no language currently proposed that would restrict it to the middle of the lot. And as I said, it would be a standard that applies to the mixed-use zoning district for the two sub-areas, but before any buildings are built, it would have to go through a discretionary process where the Planning Commission would have to find that's appropriate for where they place it. And if it's right on the street, they could find that it's perhaps not appropriate to put a building with a 45-foot tall element right on the street and have it set back a distance in the lot.
So there's actually there would be reason to believe if you read this that you could build a 45-foot building on it.
Maximum height, but it wouldn't be necessarily entitled straight across the board.
Councilman Arnold?
Yes, thank you. Who paid for the original EIR? Do you remember?
At the time, I believe it was Chuck Baker and the Kawaoka family, the developers prior to SNS.
So it was an extensive EIR that dealt with all the sub-areas and not specifically just 3 and 4?
It dealt with the overall specific plan area, and the sub-areas 3 and 4 lacked any specific development proposal, so the general commercial district was used to estimate the magnitude of development that might occur under general commercial. And as such, the addendum more specifically discusses the impacts of this particular project.
Currently, suppose if sub-area 3 were to propose more residential, there's no provision in here to share the cost of a new EIR with sub-area 4. I always get them mixed up. We're doing 4 first is what's the proposal.
Commission, when we first brought this forward, I think it was either 10 or 20,000 square feet, and the commission requested that that be bumped up to 40 to basically preclude any condo conversion in the future of what would be apartments.
And then just so that I'm not interpreting one of these pages wrong, I think it was page 2. It's actually underneath the chart under specific plan proposal sub-area 3 and 4. This is currently what's specified for the area, not what's being proposed. I apologize for not telling you what attachment. I should have stapled all this, but I think it is just page 2 of the specific plan. There's a chart at the very top that shows the...
Exhibit A.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, yes. That is...
Specifically on here, there's two paragraphs that talk about kind of what's happening right now. In the first one, under purpose and objective, it specifically says this amendment to the Berry Gardens specific plan establishes allowed uses and development standards for the Gateway Mixed Use specific plan zoning district for sub-areas 3 and 4, which are intended by Berry Gardens specific plan to be developed together. That is currently in existence, this paragraph. It's not something that's being proposed. Is that correct?
No, this is being proposed. The current Berry Gardens specific plan is basically a blank page when it comes to sub-areas 3 and 4.
So we don't have anything right now regarding 3 and 4 that talks about their joint development or the fourth bullet talks about produce a functional, aesthetically pleasing project that will serve as a landmark for the city of Arroyo Grande. Neither one of these concepts right now exists anywhere in regards to sub-area 3 and 4?
The only thing that exists currently is the existing Berry Gardens specific plan just talks about it puts 3 and 4 together, whereas sub-area 2 was called out separately for its future development. So we've been under the assumption all along that the original plan implies that they be developed together. As far as the fourth bullet, we came up with that just looking at general plan policies, both in land use and economic development, that specify that the corner of Cortland and Grand be a mixed-use pedestrian-friendly developed area for both economic development and to implement the mixed-use land use strategies. And we felt, obviously, the best way to do that is to ensure that although they could develop at different times, that what gets developed work as a functional development.
With that in mind, then, right now there is no agreement between the two landowners regarding access across. There's talk of payment for easements, but right now if sub-area 4 were to be developed without an agreement with sub-area 3, there would have to be a retaining wall put down the middle, basically right on the edge of the property, if I understand correctly.
Yes.
So that really would kind of not work with that paragraph in my mind.
That's correct.
That's all for now. Thank you.
Thank you. Ryan, I have a question. Regarding the mutually beneficial infrastructure costs of $152,910 each.
And it's my understanding that to make it work as a whole, it has to be a looped system. So they would have to install that and at least stub it to subarea 3.
So if the owners of subarea 4 went forward, developed their side of it, and subarea 3 did not go forward, subarea 3 then would not purchase any of the easements. They would be sitting there available if they needed them or wanted them. Mm-hmm. The mutually beneficial infrastructure would lie there fallow, unused.
Okay. For that portion, for the subarea 3's portion, it would be used by subarea 4.
Okay. I think those are the only questions I have at this time. This is a public hearing, so at this point, we would invite anyone that has comments on this to come forward, please.
Good evening, Mayor Pro Tem and council members. My name is Ruth Matsumoto Day. I am the current legal owner of subarea 3. And even though I'm the legal owner, I think of my parents as still owning that property. They have owned that property for 50 years. They farmed it for 40 years, and they had a strawberry stand on that property and grew strawberries. I want to go back to history a little bit because I don't think we would even be here today were it not for my intervention and influence over my parents. When the city of Aurora Grande in 1991 went through a major, major general plan revision, they deemed that Aurora Grande would continue to be and forever be an agricultural community. And in doing so, they looked at all agriculture as being land that would be kept in perpetuity as agriculture. And what happened in this process was that landowners who generations had farmed their properties would never be able to develop if they determined that they wanted to quit, they would have to sell their properties as ag property rather than as development for housing or any other kinds of development. Thereby, they would be ensuring that Aurora Grande continued to be an agricultural community. And the reason I bring the history up is that many people are not aware of what happened during this period from 1991 to present and why we're here this evening. If I hadn't intervened, there would be no Berry Gardens today. There would be no development of Berry Gardens. And the reason is that at the time the city deemed agricultural land, they deemed 45 acres right there on Grand Avenue would be considered agricultural property. Property that was fronting Grand Avenue now became from commercial to agriculture. My parents' property, as well as Mr. Young's property next door, which was subarea 4. And so what happened at that time was that the city moved forward and said only if all four could agree on what was to be done with that property. They realized that being in the middle of a city, they couldn't keep this 45 acres as an ag, as in other outlying areas. So they said at a certain point, they would allow the development of this 45 acres to go forward as long as a specific plan was brought forward in concert by four separate owners. And that can only happen after all farming ceased in that area. And at the time, the Kaukas, who were the major owners of the property, 35 acres, which became part of Berry Gardens, could no longer farm. But the city said it will remain ag. They did sue the city. They had a purchase order in place. But with that action that was given, they could not proceed. They had to stay in ag. And at the time, the city put certain provisions on us saying you must use it as ag land unless you prove that you cannot make a living on that property as ag, which meant there was an income standard of support for four family members at $34,500 or something around there. And if you couldn't prove that, you couldn't quit farming, which was a strange thing that they put upon us. And at that time, they were saying, if you yourself quit, you still had to have someone else take over and farm that land. The Kaukas could no longer farm it because they had lawsuits from surrounding perimeter homes that said pesticides were going into their water, and they were suing the Kaukas for that. And because of that, no pesticide company would provide them with pesticides for fear of liability. So they could no longer, in effect, farm in the way they had been doing previously. And because my parents owned 5 acres and had a very highly visible strawberry stand, if they wanted to still farm that property today, they could have still been farming it, and nothing would have happened in the 45 acres. And when this happened in 1991, my parents decided to make a trust. I was the trustee, and I said to them, do you realize the enormity of what's been placed on your shoulders? If you continue to farm, none of these 45 acres would be developed, because you are still in farming. And the provision by the city was, unless all farming ceased, there would be no development and nothing brought forward in a specific plan. And so, after 1991, and my parents were both, there is a farmer next to you who is suffering right now because he can no longer farm, but yet the city won't allow development until you quit. And I can understand it because, and I want to bring up the fact that it's appropriate that we're talking about this today, because next month you are celebrating your 21st Strawberry Festival. My mother, her strawberry stand and her strawberries were the catalyst for the original Strawberry Festival. They asked her to be the strawberry queen, the very first Strawberry Festival. She was asked again on the second one. When they came to her for the third, she said, I'm going to retire, so I will not, you know, stand as the strawberry queen and hostess. But they said, no, it didn't matter if you retire. Please keep being the queen for as long as you can. And she said, no, give the opportunity and publicity to others. And she said, no, I cannot do it. Now, and interesting enough, I think that the reason that there was such a catalyst to do this Strawberry Festival was that the Chamber of Commerce was being inundated or continually asked by the public at large from all areas of California, where can we go to the strawberry stand to get the white paper wrapped strawberries? And they knew exactly what they were talking about. That was the most visible strawberry planting fields that the city had at that time. You cannot see strawberry fields anywhere else readily. And so what happened was that I intervened and I influenced my parents to say, the Kaukas need to develop at this point. You have to stop. And with a heavy heart, my parents did say, okay, they knew the Kaukas would never ask them to please stop farming so that they could benefit from their land. So I said, you have to make that decision. And they did. They did. They said, okay, we will stop. Though they were deluged by offers of leasing the land, farming it, leasing the stand, and using that, I told them, if there is green growing on this land, the city will not renege, will not give in to the fact that farming can no longer happen. If somebody's willing to rent it to do it, so they didn't rent it. They left it totally unfarmed. Eventually, we tore down the stand because people seeing the stand there kept coming with offers. Okay? And then eventually Berry Gardens was proposed. And the reason that the subarea 3 and 4 has no concept plan of development is because when Berry Gardens was proposed, they also proposed a plan for subarea 3 and 4, 3 and 4 being clearly commercial, were not involved. And so at that point, they said, well, we did say you had to all come in with a plan for the entire 45 acres. But since we couldn't agree on what was to be done with subarea 3 and 4, it was left with the overlay that brought it back at commercial without any specific plan. Consequently, Berry Gardens went in, and subsequently, subarea 4 changed hands several times. From the young, Mr. Young passed away, the young heirs took over. They couldn't get rid of their property because subarea 3 and 4 had to be worked together. And then they sold to Erval for their pension plan. They thought they were making a good deal because it was cheap. They found out they could do nothing. And then they sold it to AutoZone. AutoZone found they couldn't get it past the city council here. City council did not want an AutoZone in their gateway. And they worked hard, okay? There were several plans that they submitted to myself as well. And trying to work that through, it never went through because the city never accepted them as being in the gateway. So they had to try to sell their property again to recoup the monies they had put in. S&S came and bought that. Now, we are here today because 14 years after the 91 general plan, I feel that I'm being pushed a certain extent to accept a certain thing that I would like to slow down slightly. I had asked the Planning Commission for a 90-day extension. They didn't accept that. But I have several people that I would like to have you hear, and it just is amazing to me because tonight it seems almost very apropos that Mr. Mankins was honored, because my mother was always so proud that Mr. Mankins took two trays of her strawberries to the White House during this time that her strawberries were so becoming so renowned. But I'm just asking again if we can just get a 90-day extension. I have a potential buyer who does this kind of project. They are experienced. They are capable. And I am so pleased with them. But depending on what happens this evening, they may or may not stay in the process. I have been given an offer. It may be rescinded. And I would like to, at this point, ask Jeff Emmerich of EDA to speak on my behalf.
Okay. We appreciate your comment. We ask to try to stay to 3 minutes, please.
Good evening. My name is Jeff Elmitz. Most developers are either residential developers or commercial developers.
This plan requires substantial import of earth onto this site. If you drive by it today, you can tell where the property line is because one side is 7 to 10 feet higher. Much of the grading needed to support this plan has already been done on subarea 4. If this plan is approved, it landlocks, it dictates that the residential portion of subarea 3 has no access other than to Cortland through somebody else's property. And then it goes on to say that the owners of subarea 3 have to pay for that right. The city, in approving this, is restricting access to Grand Avenue. And this one portion in the back is required. It does not have the option of having access to Grand Avenue. We feel that this specific plan amendment prevents the highest and best use of the property, and that is it is limiting the number of residential uses. Why? Through expediency. Because you don't have to mess with the EIR. So you're going to accept a fewer number of units through this specific plan amendment. And make no doubt, they say we can come back and change it. But once this plan is approved, it becomes far more difficult to propose something innovative, to propose something better for the city. They're talking about three access easements being required, and I'd submit that only one is required. The access easement, if Ryan, you could put up the picture, through the commercial portion of the site really is for convenience of the people using that parking area to get to Cortland. That part of the site has access to Grand Avenue. Construction can go on there, and there's no need for that easement. The other part is that Area 4, according to the specific plan, is underparked. They have an 11% reduction in the parking standards because of mixed use. What they're proposing is an office building and a restaurant. How does that get to mixed use? Whereas the Area 3 has the full parking per the standards. So I'm going to say that people are going to be using the parking spaces that are open. But Area 4 is imposing a parking liability on Area 3. Now, the cost of the easements is going to be a reimbursement that's imposed on subarea 3. According to the specific plan, the day a building permit is pulled for Phase 1, which is Area 4. If you approve this tonight, they can go in tomorrow and get an electric permit, temporary electric permit, and that triggers a shared access from Grand Avenue. And this access, if it was built without the approval of the owner of subarea 3, would only be 15 feet wide. It won't meet fire department standards. It can't be built without a retaining wall or slope easements onto Area 3. This is a big imposition on this project. I'd like to address a couple of the findings shown here on page 204 of the resolution. Just a couple of issues here, please. Finding number 2 in the italics section. The proposed specific plan amendment addresses and resolves critical coordination of infrastructure improvements between areas 3 and 4. The land use pattern is such that it creates these conflicts. It does not resolve them. The land use pattern is running in an east-west direction, whereas the property lines are running north and south. Finding number 4.
The specific plan amendment includes standards for building height that take advantage of the unusual existing grades of the...
What are you reading?
I'm reading from page 2 of 4 of the resolution. These are your findings for tonight.
I've got page 2 of 4 in front of me.
The resolution?
Yeah.
Specific plan amendment findings?
Title of the page, top of the page, resolution number blank, SPA 03-001, April 26, 2005, page 2 of 4.
I'm looking at what is the fifth page of the staff report presented to me by staff.
Okay.
And this is, if it's different on yours, sir, it would be in the findings.
Could I see what you're reading, please?
Certainly.
That I'm looking at the same thing too. So it is this. Okay. All right.
Finding number 4 includes standards for building height that take advantage of the unusual existing grades of the project area. These unusual existing grades are being filled. This is not taking advantage of the existing grades on the site. The total site is being regraded. Now, I didn't come here tonight just to offer criticism. I do have a suggestion that I think might help this whole project along, and that would be to have staff assist us with a lot line adjustment to rotate the property line 90 degrees to create two parcels of roughly the same area, the southerly parcel being the residential component, which would be in tune with Ruth's vision of the property, the northerly portion being commercial mixed use, which supports the direction that the owner of Area 4 wants to go with that. So that's just a suggestion.
And fill. And as was suggested, I believe that the way to address these completely without any future problems is the lot line adjustment. That would eliminate the need for securing easements and the installation of infrastructure improvements. The cooperation necessary to develop the two parcels would be greatly reduced, if not eliminated altogether, and the elevation differences in fill would also be eliminated or drastically reduced. I have some questions about the legality of some of the proposed amendments, some portions of the proposed amendment. The addendum to the EIR, which assumes that the addition of 56 apartments to the plan would not substantially affect the conclusions in the certified EIR, I believe is a potential problem. And as Mr. Guthrie raised earlier, the 56 apartments, the assumption that that would not substantially affect the traffic conclusions in the EIR, I think, is also a questionable conclusion. The reimbursement provisions that are proposed, I think, not only were not at arm's length, but I think are even more confusing when we don't know at this point whether all three easements are required. So if Mrs. Day is required to start being obligated to pay on these easements, how do you determine what that amount is? You can't at this point. Also, a 7% interest rate that would commence immediately, I think, is not marketable. And whether the city can get this involved in an agreement between two adjacent landowners, I think, is also questionable as to how they could, what their position would be and how it could be enforced. I think that's really whether the city mentioned in this, or the staff report mentions that it's an equitable resolution, but that's the city coming in and making a determination between two landowners, which I think is really the province of the courts. It's been a long process for Mrs. Day, as she said, and I understand that S&S Homes has been working a while and would like to get this started, but I think the lot line adjustment will really result in a much better project for the landowners and for the city, and we're not required too much of a delay before it can get started. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, Mayor Pro Tem, City Council. My name is John Mack, architect for S&S Homes. Also, the architect has been working on this since October of 2003 with both property owners. I like to language or put some extra verbiage in there. The issue was, again, there's going to be sloping topography. The contours of this site as it existed originally was up at the street level. There was a cross slope from front of the site to the rear of the site of approximately 10 feet. So what we're planning to do is to accommodate that cross slope, provide a more level and usable area off of Grand Avenue for project, the presentation of the project and the commercial use. And then the front of the building would not appear any more than 35 feet from Grand Avenue. We had the exercise of, well, how do we show this varying height as you circle the perimeter of the building? Because we're going to have a cross slope along Cortland. You would never have a building side that would be over 35 feet off of Cortland as well. To the rear of the project, it would not be over 35 feet in that plane. But if you measured it from this side, there would be another small element in the distance from the residential component. So I'm hoping that brings some clarification. It wasn't to use everywhere on the flat portions of the site, but specifically dealing with a split level design where the parking was going to go underneath the structure. With regards to a density, we brought this project before Planning Commission twice, Staff Advisory Committee, Architectural Review Committee, and going through a series of mediations, meeting with staff, and we believe the plan that's before you is all that put together into one plan, all the comments, all the requests, the type of product that we wanted to provide for this community. We have expensive homes. We have expensive condominiums. We have expensive smaller homes. The need that we found and that we're going towards was apartments, providing that other area for a community, which this city so desperately lacks, and that's affordable rentals. That's not to say that if you approve the use on this tonight that you couldn't do condominiums. The site area that was proposed, the minimum 40,000 square feet, well, you can do airspace condominiums in that just as easily as you can do apartments. Again, it's the minimum site area and the project that you put in there. You can have airspace condominiums, do a condominium map. Everyone has common interest and the pro rata share for condom project. The thing that we're opposed to that we don't want to have happen is a delay. I believe sub-area 3 is actually 4, is asking, I keep getting those confused. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Is asking for a 90-day extension. And their extension, from what I'm hearing, is to see if they can increase the residential component, which would further require an EIR. I've heard from Ryan that maybe it's just a negative deck. But I think the densities that this sub-area owner would like would increase it and further trigger an EIR. An EIR can't be done in 90. What we found and it was developing again with a long-term relationship with staff and with the engineering department also being represented and plan check going back and forth with some infrastructure design ideas and goals. Bottom line, in terms of the infrastructure, which is also identified in the cost estimate report, part of the infrastructure includes upgrading of the Berry Gardens sewer lift station. They want that upgrade to happen once. There'll be a benefit for both parcels. How is that paid for? So the cost estimate that was submitted for that infrastructure was the entire site development, all the utilities for our project alone, being the right-hand parcel, and then the effects that all this development would have downstream. And the pro rata share was only based on the shared utilities that ended up going downstream. It wasn't for our parcel that had drop inlets and other further infrastructure. So we're just asking for fair share reimbursement to help pay for that. And through a couple meetings that we had with the adjacent property owner, that wasn't found to be unreasonable at that time. Today's a different story. We've heard a lot of comments about the design. Jeff Emmerich hasn't been a part of the past 2 years. He's been a part of the past 2 weeks. I haven't really had time to sit down with Jeff and show him all the hard work that's gone into the plan. But there's been a lot of hard work, a lot of hard work with staff's time, mediation with both property owners, development reviews, planning commission. I believe we have a good workable plan. I believe if we do entertain the suggestion that Jeff has brought up tonight with a lot line adjustment, it wouldn't affect this Berry Gardens specific plan amendment. We're still talking residential in this quadrant, commercial up above. The language can stay as is. Property lines can adjust in the future. Don't see that being an issue with your approval tonight. The easements. I'd like to talk about those. I know I'm jumping and skipping around. But as you heard earlier tonight, staff was requiring this alignment over to Long's, this driveway alignment, excuse me for shaking. There's a driveway alignment that isn't just for the purposes of cutting across. I guess it's a long-term vision, a long-term goal of having that access continue along other properties as well. And it's really to benefit the commercial aspect and the mixed retail space in the forward third of the property, as well as letting utilities connect there as well. Part of the thing that I don't know if Jeff fully realizes is a storm drain was proposed to come over to the Popular Basin to cut over here. It's going to be very difficult with staff and also a planning commission and some of the recommendations that recognize, hey, there's a possibility to reduce the amount of parking stalls. If we don't want to have that parking stall reduction, we can live without it. Our restaurant would get a little bit smaller. We have no problem with that. What you don't recognize on this plan, or it would be really hard to make out, is if you look on the word underneath this building, it's a parking structure down below. So we have another 22, 24 stalls, which you don't see because it's underneath the building footprint. I don't believe this proposal prevents anything from being creative. I mean, we're both architects, we're both designers. I believe the proposal that we've gone through architectural review and have our preliminary approvals for is quite creative. I had a lot of good feedback from planning commissioners and from the architectural review committee. So I do have a timeline. I won't put it up, but I put a timeline that extends over a sheet of paper that does not include all the hard work that we put in to date. And it started back in August of 2003, developing plans, passing plans back and forth with Ruth Day, working with staff, inviting everybody's participation. And we're ready to go. We'd like to see this move forward. I don't believe the approval of this tonight would prevent them to bring anything else more creative than what you have before you and amend it even further. What we don't have is we don't have that creative idea before us to look at. This is the one we have before you tonight to look at. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that has comment on this issue? Seeing none, I'll close the public comment and bring it back to the council. And before we start to get comments from the members of the council, I have a couple of questions for staff. Does anyone else have questions for staff?
One also.
Well, why don't you go ahead and start?
There was a mention about the airspace condos, and I'd asked that question prior with the 40,000 square feet, which would have limited it to. I mean, my understanding was if we're going to start carving it up into smaller lots, whether they be airspace or not, then we're not restricting it. So is there confusion on the applicant? Is there confusion on staff, us, as to whether or not this can become a for-sale project?
I believe the intent that the Planning Commission gave was to prevent future subdivision of what would be built as apartments. And I think that, as I said, I think that's where the 40,000 square foot minimum came in. And that's coming from the Planning Commission. If the council wanted to allow condos, that's completely within your purview. It may be that if we want to keep it as apartments, then more strict language be added in to make
sure that subarea 3 is required to provide the easements really forever, but they aren't necessarily. But subarea 3 is not actually ever required to pick them up and pay for them.
It's correct. It's what's identified now. Any amendment in the future could change it completely and find that they're not required at all, in which case they would just go away based on the new plan.
That's really the intent of the additional language here, to better clarify that. That was the intent originally, but that wording was added to better clarify that they're only required to pay for the easements that they use.
And we're just establishing their value as of today.
Yes.
Well, there appears to be a fundamental misconception that these easements are being sort of compelled to be used. this is a difficult situation where you're trying to coordinate planning between two parcels owned by different property owners, and this was staff's attempt at bridging that gap, at actually taking pains to make sure that there was coordination, even if they didn't develop at the same time. Subarea 4 or subarea 3 can come in any time for an amendment. They can develop wholly within their own boundaries. They can use retention basins on site. Again, it's not the highest and best use to put a retention basin to capture the water that's on that site. That's the reason why you have this flexibility built into the plan. But I think it's presumed that down the line there will be amendments. At least that's the way I looked at it. This is not cast in stone. On the other hand, it does provide a starting point. It fleshes out a lot of the issues that are critical issues if you're going to develop this in a coordinated, a logical fashion. But they're not being compelled to use any of the easements. They could end up using none, one, or submit an amendment that changes the entire configuration and use.
At least these three access points.
If they want to pursue them.
Yeah, that whole clause was drafted specifically for the purpose of protecting subarea 3, so that they would have the ability to have access to those easements at any point in time that they need them.
And on the idea of the lot line adjustment, had staff had that come forward before? So that's a new development tonight as well. Okay. Those are my only questions.
Thank you. I have one question also. If we were to pass this as proposed tonight, and two owners could never agree, sub area four could go forward. However, my belief is that it might not be able to go forward as it's proposed now because they might have to put in some sort of retaining walls and they might have to alter their plan. So simply passing this tonight doesn't mean that it's going to be built this way, particularly if there's no agreement. Is that a correct assumption?
Sub-area 4 has submitted alternative grading plans that show a potential for retaining wall rather than slope banks that would in any way intrude on the western property. I think that their intent is to pursue the use permit. Until a use permit is approved and construction commences, nothing is cast in stone. As soon as they build in accordance with the plan, at least that.
Just wondering, is this the first time this has actually come to council? I mean, I'm confusing the number of. It is the first time at council, okay. Because I've reviewed this a number of times at planning commission level. And I think what. Did you want to make? I'm sorry.
I believe that the pre-application did come up to the prior council as well as the prior planning commission. And then in the current sequence, this is the first time the council under current composition has received it.
Yeah, in going back through the history that I have with this project, that this came forward, what one side's ready to develop, and what was really the concern of Planning Commission, and I believe of staff at that time, was to guarantee the opportunity that sub-area 3 could, in fact, be developed in the future and could be developed efficiently. Yes, technically, you could do access directly off of Grand Avenue, not have any hookup with the other area at all, but that's actually very undesirable for the city to have multiple accesses onto Grand Avenue that interrupt traffic flow. Beyond that, you'd need a secondary access as well at some point because the fire department would require it. So I'm not sure that sub-area 3 could develop without at least one of the easements across sub-area 3, and that's what we were looking at. Now, granted, this plan is probably the commercial part of it is prepared to go forward and I'll say is set in stone, although nothing's set in stone. But what we wanted to do was guarantee that there would be the opportunity to develop the other piece of property. And I think we accomplished that here. I think that, yeah, it's pretty scary that the values are established here, but they do, in fact, have value. And, in fact, I think that it's legally required, but it's also reasonable that we would in fact establish a value for them going forward at this point and establish the fact that it's going to increase in value over time. I'm a little uncomfortable with the 7%, and we through discussion may talk about that. Maybe 7% is too high, but there does have to be some sort of opportunity cost, if you will, for the value of these easements. I also don't believe that it does take away potential changes on sub-area 3 if we go forward with this. In fact, it just maintains multiple opportunities. If you can find a way to develop with a single easement, then that's very much to your advantage. In fact, if anything, because sub-area 4 is going forward at this point, they're being required to guarantee these easements. They're being required to install utility easements and utility improvements that, in fact, they may never be reimbursed for. So, if anything, this to me ends up being a burden on sub-area 4 going forward from here. I do have on the language for the 45-foot rule, I would like to see some sort of language where we can sort of specify that, in fact, it's going to sit in the middle of the property, that we're really not talking about 45-foot buildings in any form sitting out on Grand Avenue. I don't think that's the intent here. I am a little concerned that somebody could come in later and say, well, you know, I think we can do a 45-foot building up here in front, and some sort of language that would protect us on that. I had one other so was that, in fact, we would be providing apartments where we're not going to be able to provide apartments anywhere else in town. If, in fact, it's possible to increase the density here. If that does work out, then I might be open to, when they came back with that there would be 54 apartments and some number of condominiums or something. But at this point, I think providing the 54 apartments is really what we're looking for, and one of the benefits to our community that we're looking to come from this. So I'd be prepared to move forward with this evening. Oh, just one quick comment on the lot split. I do think the lot split, even though it sounds like a good idea, when you actually look at splitting the lot in half, it precludes developing the back half of the commercial property, or at least makes it much more difficult because of the alignment issue with the access point. Once you split this 50-50 front to back, it's almost right on top of the major access point that we want to have on this property. So I think it would not be necessarily be the best use of this property to split it in half 50-50. I also think it precludes true mixed use. Would actually be the potential that you might have some residential component on the front half, on the front two-thirds of this property. It would just make it too small a commercial site to ever have a true mixed-use project instead of a dense residential project and a commercial project in front. So I don't see the lot split as a really great alternative. So those are my comments at this point, and I would be prepared to go forward this evening with it as it's proposed with those two changes. And I'd like to hear some discussion on the 7% as well, because that does seem a little excessive to me. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Guthrie. Mr. Arnold.
Thank you. I'm going to take a little bit different tact. I'm definitely not ready to go forward. Kind of some of the things that I read, some of the notes in the Planning Commission and stuff that was made by the public is we've waited this long. I'm not sure what 90 more days will really cost us in the scheme of things. One of the goals of the specific plan is to have a project that looks and feels like it's one. And my concern right now is if we're basically saying we're going to put a retaining wall down the middle of this project, the likelihood that's ever going to come true is probably pretty thin. One of the accesses that's really hasn't been mentioned at all is the access off of Grand right now. It's split down the middle of the two properties. Now, I realize that Subarea 4 has the ability to move that completely onto their property, but then that would leave us with, if and when 3 comes forward, that they're going to have no guaranteed access to Grand whatsoever, or they're going to be asking for their own access to Grand, which is something we definitely do not want to see. So I'm real concerned that the 3 guaranteed accesses are actually all off of Cortland. One of the other concerns that I do have, which is reasonable to expect that this is what SNS would have come forward with, is that their accesses are optimized for their project and not for Area 3. And specifically speaking of the underground access for the large office building, which is, I think, labeled as B, that right now that entrance comes in between two other accesses, which I have a little concern with just the actual amount of crowding that we're putting on entrances there. And then it exits out on the other side, and there is no continuation side. If they wanted to do all commercial, there may not be the need for the amount of water and sewer that could be planned for. If they wanted to do more commercial or more residential, they may be undersized. So right now there's some speculation as to exactly what are going to be the needs for that side. And I hate the idea of saying you're going to pay for it if you don't need all of that, or you're going to tear up stuff to put in more capacity. As far as the actual easements go, right now, as this plan is configured, there's no doubt that Subarea 4 has a benefit on Subarea 3, too, with some of the flow through traffic, especially in the apartment side or the residential side. Right now, there is not, as configured, the ability for the units to loop around without actually going up to a portion on Subarea 3. Could it be reconfigured? Yes, but then we're getting back to the whole idea that this is not what it's supposed to be, which is a cohesive plan. The same thing would really work with the access on the parking lot up top. I definitely am real concerned with underparking this project, since we're talking about a restaurant that's going to be in a great location and that will probably do very well. And so, therefore, the idea that this is mixed use in the truest sense, I'm struggling with the idea that we're going to have that kind of use to where people are going to live in the apartments, work in the office building, and use the restaurant, and that's where we get a reduction. I think we're seeing it in Longs, where there's a lot of days when that parking lot is full. And it shows what happens when you build a successful project. And I think this will be a successful project. So I'm definitely concerned with starting off underparked. Let's see. This is kind of random notes here, so I just want to make sure I cover everything. I also have concern about the EIR, that if subarea 3, this is we're all having struggles with the names, were to propose something that were to exceed the residential that's proposed here right now, that it could trigger an EIR, which would be completely on their back. And if this is supposed to be a joint project or a joint plan, that we're talking about all these other expenses that have to be shared with Area 3, then maybe 4 should be sharing in that expense. And there's no discussion on that. I know this is something that Subarea 3 is looking for, and I will have to reiterate what the Council Member Guthrie said, is I'm not looking for condos here. I could definitely be consider some if we exceed the number of units that we're talking right now, but the city desperately needs apartments. Nobody wants to build them. I would have never allowed the change in Camino Mercado, and I'm not going to allow it here. We've been talking apartments from day one, and I think we need to get some apartments here. If we can get some apartments through an increased density and then get some condos, too, to make it a more viable project, I'd be completely in favor of that. But I do think we need to see some apartments built here. My preference on how I'd like to see this handled is if after 90 days you don't submit a plan, then I'm going to be real inclined to say, you know, because I know at Planning Commission I'm really struggling. I'm not trying to pit one side against the other and give one side more leverage than the other. That's not my goal here. And this is, I think, a challenge of everybody. And at this point so far, as today, so everybody will benefit. But those are my thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold.
Mr. Dickens.
Mayor Pro Tem, thank you. I've got a lot of thoughts I'm going to throw out here, and hopefully they'll make sense when I get done. First of all, I want to thank Mrs. Day for her history, and I think it's vitally important that we have an understanding of where we've been and why we're here today. So I appreciate you taking the time to do that. I think that's extremely important to us. There are a couple statements that were made that I just kind of want to use as my cornerstone as to my comments. And one was from Jeff Embrick in regards to the ability to propose something better for the city. And I think that all of our goals are to have what's in the best interest of the city. And I'm hearing a property owner that would like to move forward and do something like that, and yet I'm seeing a the fact that you're uncomfortable at this particular stage. Not that something won't happen, but at what is being proposed, and basically not feeling comfortable with the speed in which, and feeling comfortable with where we're at. And I can sympathize with that. I think that's important, especially for someone who doesn't do this professionally. You're bringing in folks that do this, and I think it's, even though maybe a little later in the game, I think it's appropriate. And I think that my goal is definitely to have something on those properties that are, it's going to be a betterment to the city. It's coming to what is that is the real question. And unfortunately, we've got some folks out there that know exactly, I think, how to make that happen. And it will take cooperation. The other comment that I believe Mr. Mack made in regards to, you know, there's been a lot of work put into this. There's been a lot of mediation. There's been a lot of meetings. Staff has done a great job of trying to help bring the parties together to come to some conclusion, which is kind of what we have before us this evening. And I applaud, you know, all the parties in regards to trying to bring forth a spirit of cooperation and seeing something happen. And what I'm hearing is everyone that's here would like to see something happen and would like to move forward, but it's a matter of making sure that all parties come together at the same speed and maintaining that level of comfort. And I think that that's definitely appropriate, and I would support that. Unfortunately, with all the stuff that's gone on in the past, us as council members aren't privy to that. It all comes down to the public hearing. And when we're presented with all this material on a Friday afternoon and I have to absorb it, I don't know all the hard work. And I'm not saying there wasn't. And I know there's a lot of stuff that's been done. and yet, there's way too many unanswered questions in my mind. And maybe that's part of my comfort level, where I need to feel comfortable with what we're presenting, which leads me to some of the questions that I have right now and the reason why I cannot support moving forward. I don't agree with that. I think that, one, we have traffic issues that need to be dealt with. I'm not convinced with what I see before me that hasn't been addressed. So I believe that needs to be addressed. I'm not sure that means a full-fledged EIR. I just think that we need to go back to the original EIR, look at the assumptions that were made, and give me some sort of a traffic study, which I don't have before me this evening. The issue of water. It's been a long time since we've addressed water issues. We will have a substantial change. General commercial uses less water than residential. That needs to be addressed in some sort of form or fashion. The height issue, I understand. I understand what's being proposed, and I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, but I'm not sure why we're making the exception at this stage of the game. We did not have to do an exception to approve the Cortland Senior Housing Project. They have a very similar situation, and I do not believe we did not make an amendment that soon in the game. They brought forth a proposal that was sound. It was in the best interest of that particular development, and we approved those height standards and made those amendments at that particular time. I'm uncomfortable with a 45 foot height exception at this particular time as part of this amendment. I think it's too ambiguous, and it's we're making statements that, well, it's really for this and this and this. I don't know what this and this is yet, so we'll get there. And I'm not to say that that's a bad idea. I need to see it as part of the proposal that comes forth. I think there's some unforeseen legal issues that I'm not comfortable with moving forward at this particular time. I think that I'm just not comfortable with what's been presented, with the easement issues. The 7%, is that equitable? Is it not equitable? In my opinion, it's not the city's job to determine whether that is or isn't. It's up to the two property owners to make those agreements. I think we're stepping in some areas that are a little I feel uncomfortable with, and I'd rather work cooperatively than push something on someone that's not comfortable with that at this particular time. The issue of apartments versus condos, that was an issue that came up when we, interestingly enough, approved an apartment complex on Camino Mercado. And after all was said and done, the applicant came back and said, well, you know, we penciled it all out and it doesn't work. We need to go to condos. That was, I guess, appropriate at that time, and it was approved. I'm with the rest of the council. We need apartments. That's something I think will help create the affordable housing stock within the city of Arroyo Grande. So I'm not convinced that we need condos, and I want to make sure that whatever's proposed is penciled out and that we're looking at apartments if that's part of the project.
Bottom line is our goal is to create an integrated, cohesive project between these two to maybe resolve some of these issues so that there is a comfort level. I'm hearing that there will be something that moves forward. As Councilmember Arnold pointed out, and he's done a lot more looking at this, but there are some significant issues. If we move forward now without dealing with the joint easement off of Grand Avenue, without dealing with the height issues, yes, each property owner can come forward and do their own individual thing. I'm not sure that's a benefit for either one. So I don't see them saying that. I'm thinking there is going to be cooperation. We're going to see something, and by doing so, we're going to have a project even better than it's being proposed in the concept we have today before us. So right now, I'm asking my direction would be to ask staff to go back, address the environmental issues, and at least bring forth a little more detail in regards to, one, the original certified EIR and the assumptions that were made. And based on the amendment and the maximum densities, heights, and so forth, what that would then do to traffic, circulation, water usage, so forth. That's one of the things I'd like to see, and hopefully while you're doing that, the two property owners can come to some conclusions about what may be appropriate for both. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I'll make my comments fairly brief. I've heard a lot of things up on the panel here tonight that makes sense. We can approve this tonight, and we're not going to have a cohesive project. I don't think. Without agreement between the two owners of the two pieces of property, we could approve this concept tonight, and unfortunately, we would end up, or we're likely to end up with sub-area 4 going forward with no agreements, and the project would not look like what they've proposed to us. I'd like to review myself what the original EIR said, just to see, because I'm looking at the environmental impacts here in a vacuum. Not that that means that we need a new environmental impact report, but I just don't know this concept, and I can't put the item in front of me in relationship to what the original environmental review said. So I don't know whether it's consistent with the original environmental review. I think there's a lot of unanswered questions. There may be a lot line adjustment that'll work. That doesn't mean it would be a 50-50 one. There might be a 60-40 adjustment that left the front portion in commercial or in mixed use, and I don't see mixed use here, incidentally, and the rear portion in residential. As a product of living in apartments growing up, I see nothing wrong with apartments. I think I agree we do need them, so I think that it'd be a positive thing to go forward. If we went to a much greater density in terms of how many units we put on this piece of property, though, I'd really want to look at that and see what the impacts were in terms of traffic, density, water use, how that all fits together. So I'd have to echo the comments I just heard, that I can't support going forward with this tonight either. That said, I invite a motion.
Mr. Pro Tem. you said, I'd like to propose that we postpone this to July 26th, which would be the 90 days that has been.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
No.
And Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes. Thank you. And I'll ask before the mayor comes back, we take a break for 5 to 10 minutes.
Okay, council is back in session. Takes us to 9C, consideration of a proposed ordinance amending Rio Grande Municipal Code, permitting requirements applicable to auto vehicle parts sales without installation.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor and council members. In February, the City Council initiated a development code amendment to conditionally allow auto vehicle parts sales without installation services in the vicinity of East Grand Avenue. The council had upheld a planning interpretation by the Planning Commission that the development code does not currently allow this use in the vicinity of the Gateway Mixed Use District on Grand Avenue. The proposed ordinance includes permit requirements for new land use category, auto vehicle part sales without installation for all commercial and mixed use districts. The requirements proposed are generally the same as those that are required for auto vehicle part sales with installation, with the exception that in the Gateway Mixed Use and Fair Oaks Mixed Use districts, there are some additional requirements. For these districts, the use could be allowed subject to a CUP, and since there's the PED designation, it would not these uses would not be able to locate in a storefront location, and an additional requirement would apply so that these uses would not be able to be located within 200 feet of East Grand Avenue. The proposed ordinance is intended to balance both the intent of the Development Code, Chapter 1636, concerning mixed-use districts, as well as policies outlined in the general plan, including the land use element and economic development element. By prohibiting auto vehicle part sales without installation in storefront locations and in the front of Grand Avenue, it forces a potential location to interior properties or the interior of commercial centers. Further, a portion of the proposed ordinance tonight is an amendment to Title 10 of the Municipal Code prohibiting automobile repair and maintenance activities in public and commercial parking lots. And this is included in the ordinance to address some concerns that were brought up in public comment at the City Council hearing initiating this Development Code amendment, as well as during the Planning Commission review of the proposed ordinance.
We do this, and we require a CUP. Could there, if an applicant, let's use AutoZone, comes in there on Cortland and Grand, can we require that the mall be upgraded as far as the quality? Because that was one of the selling points that was brought up at the last hearing, was that I want to remodel this center, but I can't until I have a client in here. And so I guess if we, when it comes forward, could that be a condition of the CUP that you have to remodel the center?
It could be a condition of the CUP. It depends on what improvements are being asked and that they're commensurate with the type of project that's being sought in the CUP. So it could, and also applicants can always offer additional improvements. But
Tim, I think you have something to say.
Well, you can impose conditions on the approval to make the use compatible. That's the purpose of a conditional use permit. But normally those conditions have to be related. There has to be some nexus between the proposed use and whatever conditions you're seeking to impose. So if it was just kind of a generic, you need to upgrade the mall and make it look a lot better, again, depending on how specific you were and how extensive the comments were and the directions were, you may not be able to get the entire mall upgraded, but certainly components within it could be addressed. And again, I think it depends on the nature of the proposal before you. If it's just for that auto zone, I think it'd be a stretch to require sort of upgrades to the entire mall.
I think you also have to keep in mind that there's several owners in that center. I mean, as far as that particular example, there's several owners, so it'd be hard to compel them to upgrade properties not that they don't own directly. But
and I realize that completely, but we're still talking about this one specific owner had kind of expressed that he was willing to do that if he was allowed to have the auto zone or fill the space. And that's where I'm struggling, because I think the concern with bringing an auto supply store into that was that we might continue to see the center deteriorate instead of trying to change the type of tenant. And so with that reasoning, could that be a logic to require more of an improvement to the pieces that he owns?
And yeah, no, I think you could certainly condition it to provide basic upgrades in the areas that are affected by the proposal. But there is a line that you probably can't go beyond where their conditions have no reasonable relationship to the use being proposed, and that's probably as far as you could go.
That's all. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Any other questions?
I had one, Mr. Mayor. Sure. Teresa, just for clarification, the Cookie Crock Center is in which zone, the Gateway Mixed Use or the Fair Oaks Mixed Use?
That's in the Gateway Mixed Use District.
And currently the Cookie Crock Center, I'll call it there's probably another name to it, but the Cookie Crock Center houses the Southern Auto
CarQuest.
Okay. At this particular time, because of our current ordinance,
I'm going to struggle again to vote again because I totally agree with Section 10 modification or the Title 10. And so what I'm looking at is, you know, not that I think it's going to happen, but we don't want to see four or five auto parts dealers that are moving in because all of a sudden now we become the auto parts capital of the area. I think that is definitely a concern, and I know that was the expression before that there are several other properties that also could meet the 200-foot setback rule and allow an auto parts. Could that be a reason, I guess, for denying a CUP also?
Given the language in, for example, this ordinance in our code, I don't think you can make that findings that an additional use or the proliferation of a certain use would prohibit an additional one from coming in. There are ways you can structure a code amendment to address the proliferation of a certain use. It's a little more difficult, but staff can certainly look into that.
I would clarify that under the findings for a conditional use permit currently, there is substantial discretion. A proposed use is permitted pursuant to the provisions of this section. And then it refers to the goals, objectives of the general plan, development policies, standards. It would not impair the integrity and character of the district in which it's to be established. The site is suitable for the type and intensity of use, and there's adequate provisions for public facilities, and that the proposed use would not be detrimental. I think if you had two or three identical type uses in a center, you could certainly find that it was not consistent with the intended character or integrity. And there is a Grand Avenue enhancement plan. While not specifically adopted, it is referred to in adopted documents and guidelines and standards. So I would tell you that in the case of a specific plan area, the city did refuse an auto parts use, and a specific plan, of course, is a method with discretion, and under a conditional use permit, you have similar discretion.
Any other questions, clarifications, and staff report? Okay, seeing none, hearing none, this is a public hearing. Any member of the audience would like to come forward and address this issue? Going once, going twice. Okay, close public comment, bring this back to the council. I'm going to take a little bit of discretion here and kick this thing off, and I want to make a couple of general observations, and they're related to position that I took on this the last time. My position has not changed, and the reason why is because of the fact that even though the development code remained vague on this issue, I recall at compatibility issues, what we attempted to do was, just as we have done in other parts of the city, namely the village, there can be business restrictions. You can, in fact, determine what is an allowable use and what isn't. It isn't a question of whether we can or cannot. We certainly can. So what we were focused on was doing long-range planning for Grand Avenue. Because that's true, we made a determination at the time, and I recall the spirit of that discussion, was that we would locate auto parts stores next to those businesses that were alike in kind. And the in terms of Grand Avenue, the segment that met those challenges was highway, because that is where the concentration of car lots are. That's where the concentration of auto repair is in the city. And it seemed logical that auto parts should be permitted in that area. In that same discussion, we focused on the gateway segment as being our centerpiece. This was going to be our statement. This was going to be where we would, in fact, encourage the best look for the city that we could put in place, and that look would be pedestrian-oriented. So, using that as a backdrop, I want to focus a little bit on some of the conditions in this item. As far as the issue of 200 feet off of Grand Avenue, in my mind, while it helps a little bit, it still doesn't deal with the issue. And for me, the issue is simply straightforward. It doesn't matter whether we have an ordinance. It doesn't matter whether we have law enforcement ready to go in with their citation books. The fact still remains it's going to be a difficult enforcement issue. And the issue in front of us is, in fact, the continuing tendency for people who frequent auto parts retailers to take those items that they purchase and install them right outside the door. I see it happening. I saw it happening as recently as yesterday. It happens. I've seen all kinds of extremes that are driven simply by the whole structure of the purchase. Namely, if you look at something like a battery, there's a battery deposit or turn-in kind of thing when you purchase it. If the person lives several miles away from the point of purchase, it's just as easy to go out in the parking lot, throw that hood up, change out the battery right there, and carry the old one back in and get a deposit, or whatever the case may be. Auto parts stores, even though they say they will, find it very difficult to step into the middle of human behavioral patterns to do these kinds of things. Just as it will be difficult for us, even though there are signs posted out there, even though we're going to have the beat car go by and take a look from time to time, it's going to happen. When it happens, the aftermath is generally an unsightly environment in and around that particular retail outlet. Informing, and Councilmember Dickens mentioned Elm and Grand. That's true. But is it a question of us, if we were to reinstate this restriction in the gateway segment, we're certainly not going to tell CarQuest they have to leave. We're not going to tell Santa Maria Tire they have to leave. They're in the gateway. So the issue here is that if you look at Elm and Grand and you look at some of the concept drawings and you look at the plan for that corner for redevelopment, it has a completely different configuration than the way that it looks now. And if we maintain, again, the spirit of where we're going with Grand Avenue, particularly the gateway segment, you're going to find a tremendous pedestrian-oriented look, I think, to that area when a project comes forth. So I'm hopeful at this point that we can go back to some of the planning assumptions that we had originally for Grand Avenue. It seems that recently the whole tenor of the direction seems to be away from making Grand Avenue the destination center and the bright spot, one of the bright spots of our city. It seems like by our own doing, we are putting businesses along Grand Avenue that do exactly the opposite. And it is disappointing to see. So this ordinance makes the best of a bad situation. My hope for this evening is that we can take a step back and rethink what I believe was originally intended for Grand Avenue, and it certainly was not auto parts stores in our gateway segment, whether they're 200 feet off of Grand Avenue or facing Grand Avenue. So I'll wait to hear the other comments, and that'll decide how I vote, but that is my, I guess, my hoped-for outcome here. So I'll get off my soapbox, and who would like to go next? You can go. Councilmember Dickens.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. The issue that I have here is, one is that I felt there was some ambiguity in regards to the development code in specific land use, and the land use for auto vehicles with parts sales without installations was not addressed. And the intent that the mayor talked about in regards to our Grand Avenue overlay, I was there. I agree that our goal is to provide for a long-term plan that's going to help create a more vibrant, pedestrian-oriented, I frequent the CarQuest folks, and I personally, and maybe it's just maybe the times I'm there, I don't see the same description that the mayor is pointing out. I just don't see it. Nonetheless, I don't say that doesn't happen. Bottom line for me is that we need to have a convenient place for people to buy auto parts. It's a retail establishment, and I think as long as we provide for the provisions with a conditional use permit, that we're not putting them directly on Grand Avenue, that we are providing for that sales outlet for our community members, I think that's what we need to do. I certainly have concerns in regards to economic development and redevelopment of that particular area, but redevelopment takes 20 to 30 years. This particular shopping center has no plans besides doing some things on the drainage basin to move forward, which can't happen if we have vacant tenants. And I'm not sure whether CarQuest is going to go in there or not. But I think that, one, we need to have less ambiguity with our code so that we have an idea of what's expected. One, two, I think we need to certainly maintain the intent of the Grand Avenue overlay in regards to our ultimate redevelopment and economic strategy there. And three, I don't see how this is going to be a major detriment to that particular area. So I think it's appropriate, and I know that may not seem accurate to some other folks, but I believe that it's imperative that we have less ambiguity and that we provide for appropriate outlets for the things that people need within the community, and I think this ordinance does that, so I can support it as presented.
Okay. Councilmember Arnold.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I've really struggled with this one. I see your points completely, and I think Councilmember Dickens just made some very good points too. And I think realistically the point that he just made about the redevelopment takes 20 to 30 years is a very viable point. It's why I asked the questions of staff that I did.
I'm inclined to vote in favor of this with the caveat that I really would like to see us make the most of any auto dealer parts stores that we get, because I see them as a stepping stone. It may be a 5 or 10 or 20 year stepping stone, but right now that center specifically, because of its multiple ownership, is a real problem center. There does not appear to be a desire on at least one of the parties, and possibly two of the parties, to sell to the one party who actually probably does have good intentions. And so with that in mind, that already gives that center a strike, and I think redevelopment there is going to be a challenge and can possibly bring to a center. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Councilmember Guthrie.
Well, I'll start by talking real quickly about the ordinance. That independent of whether we allowed auto parts stores in the gateway mixed use or just in the highway, we would certainly want an ordinance that made it illegal to dump oil in the parking lot. It's certainly not a good idea to have oil in the parking lot in the highway zone any more than it is in the gateway mixed use. Without adding too much to the comments that have already gone forward, I do see this as just another retail use. I don't see it as particularly detrimental. I mean, it's certainly not the same as having a great walk-in restaurant in a pedestrian zone, but I don't see this as a particularly detrimental use. I see it as just another retail use. And I think when we're talking about mixed use, even though we typically talk about it as residential mixed with commercial, we're also talking about a mix of uses between different commercial uses, between different retail uses. And this is one of those retail uses. Yeah, it'd be bad news to have three auto parts stores in the same shopping center. In fact, I'm somewhat encouraged by staff's comments that maybe there's some room to look at, I'll call it forced mixed use, which means that we're not going to have 10 restaurants in a shopping center as well. So I can continue to support this change. I particularly like having the ordinance added to our city code. So I can move forward with this tonight. Thanks.
Mayor Pro Tem?
I'm the member of this board that originally asked for the language here, and I'm pleased to see the language that's here. Particularly with the conditional use permit, which was not what I originally asked for. I think that's appropriate. I, too, see this as another retail use. I do recognize that there is a danger that people might do auto service outside the store. However, it should be discouraged. It's going to be illegal, and I think that we can keep that to a minimum. The protection of having it outside the pedestrian zone, outside away from Grand Avenue, is critical. The economic vitality of that center is important, and I think that the addition of a viable use in there that we can regulate can be a positive thing. I appreciate the mayor's comments on the intent for the gateway zone. I don't know that this necessarily will kill that or harm it. And I don't think that this is going to lead to a sprouting of auto parts shops through the gateway zone, particularly if they all have to go through the conditional use permit process. So I can support this with the language that came forward.
Okay. Thank you. Just a point of clarification, redevelopment, I don't believe for Elman Grand is 30 years away. I think we have some promising opportunities that are probably a couple of years away. So I disagree with that blanket assessment with regard to redevelopment. I think we've seen some good examples on Grand Avenue of concepts becoming a reality already, and it didn't take 30 years. Just some closing thoughts after listening to the comments of the council. Boy, I made what I thought was a pretty darn good. We'll entertain a motion.
Make a motion. We haven't done one of these with an ordinance. Do I just read the title? I'll make a motion that we adopt an ordinance of the City Council of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande amending Arroyo Grande Municipal Code Chapters 16.36 of Title 16 to include permitting requirements applicable to auto vehicle parts sales without installation services in commercial and mixed-use districts, and adding Chapters 10.18 to the Title 10 to prohibit auto-related maintenance and repair activity in commercial and public parking lots, Development Code Amendment 05-007.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion, further discussion? Okay, hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Diggins?
Yes.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Reluctantly. Okay, that takes us to item 10, continued business. We have none. So we'll move to item 11, new business. 11A is consideration of alternatives for the regulation of formula businesses in the city of Arroyo Grande.
In March, in response to public comment, the City Council directed staff to do some research and bring some alternatives for formula business restrictions in the village commercial area of the city. There are several cities that do regulate formula businesses. Formula businesses are more commonly known as chain stores, if it's a formula retail business. And they tend to operate in an extremely standardized manner, where all outlets maintain the same merchandise, facade, decor, and color schemes, employee apparel, and signage and trademarks. Although formula businesses can include commercial services, such as banks, most cities have approved regulations for formula businesses, draft their definitions toward a specific formula use. For example, formula restaurants or formula retail. The concern regarding potential proliferation of formula businesses is that it may detract from the character of an architecturally distinct district, hamper the maintenance of a district with distinct retail personalities, and cause startup independent retail to be priced out of the real estate market due to an inability to absorb larger startup costs, for example. There are several ways to achieve protection for the preservation of distinct districts, particularly districts with a historic character, without being discriminatory in the application of regulations on formula businesses. The first is how you define a formula business, and this is a very important determination on how they're regulated. Cities define their formula businesses quite differently. In California, prohibition of a formula business in a certain area and allowing them in other areas of the city, procedural requirements such as requiring a higher level of review for district. Some alternatives the council may wish to consider would be to direct staff to come back with an ordinance that would either prohibit formula businesses in the village districts, restrict them in the village districts, or limit their number in the village districts, or restrict and limit the number of formula businesses in the village districts. Or council may wish to pursue some other direction or require no further action. Those are the alternatives, some of the alternatives this evening, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions, clarifications for Teresa on the staff report? Councilmember Arnold, go ahead.
Looking at the different options available, one is it looks like they restrict it to a style issue, so it doesn't look like the store. In other cases, they restrict it if there's more than a certain number of a particular type of use. Have we looked at, or did you look at, the option of possibly doing some kind of blended? So I guess what I'm getting at is, let's use the village, because I think what's driven this so far is possibly Andrini's and and possibly whether a national might come into the village or something. And I think in the village specifically, we have a real unique character with our local shops here. And so my thought would be, if we didn't have a coffee shop, then maybe a chain makes sense if it doesn't look like a chain. But since we do, have you seen any of that kind of use where if you have a local, I guess, shop, then the chains can't come. If you don't, then the chain can come.
I've seen some ordinances that do blend the requirements, and that might include a dimensional requirement of 25-foot frontage that might allow another coffee shop to come in, but an additional requirement that strictly limits the number in a certain district of a formula restaurant, for example. So, yes, I have seen that type of blend in other cities.
Thank you.
Any other questions, clarifications? Councilmember Dickens.
Teresa, in regards to the village standards and guidelines that we adopted probably a year and a half ago or maybe, are those applied to just the village core downtown, or do those also include the village mixed use areas?
That includes all the area within a design overlay 2.4, which is both districts, the village mixed use and core downtown.
And within the village guidelines and standards that we adopted, I believe that we put in language that would address signage and having it conform to what we would call more of a historic district area. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
We have covered a lot of this ground already in our
difficult for those businesses to do that because of their own franchise agreements and so forth. So it does create some conflict at times.
It does. It is very difficult to get franchise operations to achieve or present a design that is compatible with what we are desiring and with our design guidelines and standards. However, I think more and more in recent years, given that more cities are having historic design guidelines adopted, it's not quite as difficult as it was a few years ago, for example.
One franchise that comes to mind is one that I think it's called the House of Bread. And I believe that is a franchise. It's typically it's a local person who buys into a franchise, but it's got a national name or something like that. But you could actually have a franchise, and I'm not very familiar with that particular one, but would actually might fit in and might have some of the characteristics that we might be looking for. So I guess from my perspective, we would want to look at a. If we were going to do a formula business, an agreement, something that wouldn't preclude those types of business, but really kind of address the character and ambiance of what the village is really trying to portray through our guidelines and standards. So that's more of a comment than a question. Thank you.
Any other clarifications, questions on the staff report?
I actually do have a question. When you're talking about the number of formula business, for instance, are you talking about that there couldn't be more than, you know, three McDonald's in the six-block area, or are we talking about that there couldn't be more than six chain fast food restaurants, or is that something we would define within the ordinance?
That would have to be worked out in the definition.
So when we say the number of franchises, it's the number of franchises, not of a specific franchisee, but of fast food in general or retail bread in general.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. You would have to define it to a fast food restaurant. You can define it further, or just leave it like that.
Anything else? Since I introduced this at the last meeting, I've been reading up on this, and in fact had a discussion with it was actually a very good discussion with our new chamber president and past president. And they had some concerns, and I think we I'm hopeful that we may have made some progress. But these things are all over the board in terms of how they're scripted, and certainly the flexibility that's sort of umbrellaed under this whole notion of a formula business restriction is tailored to meet the needs of the community. And I would assume that, Teresa, if we were to maybe state what our goal was, and this is hypothetical at this point because we haven't, nobody's firmed on a decision, the restaurants in the village. And then we have others that get into, from other cities, that get into standard menus and dress of the employees and all the rest of that. So we're all over the board. We could, in concept, tailor this to meet our goal.
We could tailor it. I just caution that allowing, for example, a house of bread may be difficult if we write an ordinance that prohibits certain formula retail in the village.
Well, I think there's a distinction, and it's a good thing you brought that. There's a distinction, I think, between a franchise and a formula business. There can be a distinction between a franchise, a locally owned franchise, as opposed to a formula business. At least that's what I get out of here. The House of Bread example, if you look at the one, I guess, that was in Paso Robles, I don't know if they are still in business. They were caught up in the earthquake. But when they were in business, they didn't look like a typical formula business does, and they were different than in look than the one that was in San Luis Obispo, is currently in San Luis Obispo in Higuera. So I think we can probably make a distinction here on issues like that. I think the caution for me comes into play if we look at San Luis Obispo and we look at what happens when we don't have something like that in play, and we look at the historic building that Carl's Jr. moved into for a short period of time. Mm-hmm. So, there are all kinds of warning flags out there.
Mm-hmm. Seems to me, Mr. Mayor, that this goes to the whole heart of the point of what we're trying to do. And we define what we mean by formula, and if we were to set the regulation that a formula business could not exist if they were wearing uniforms and had the standardized menu, and a formula restaurant came in and was willing to not wear uniforms and change their menu and change their appearance, it would seem to me that they would probably fit, and we'd allow them to come in if they conformed to the rules we had. So it's up to the definition of what we say and how we say it to clearly define exactly what the outcome is. And it sounds to me like, my intent would be to have a formula business regulation in place that was flexible enough to allow a franchise to come in that was willing to meet our guidelines and could be a successful part of the village. And that doesn't mean excluding any and all formula restaurants or formula businesses. It just means that they're going to have to adapt to the regulations we put in place for the locations we put them in place. And I think we can be successful with that.
Yeah, the only caution here is specifically the Village Center. Because that was a focus, and if you look at what currently exists there in the form of architecture, a formula business have to go. The ordinance would have to go deeper than just architecture and signage, particularly when we focus on the Village Center, which is of concern to me, and certainly in the within the framework of village mixed use. Or village core. This is not a public hearing, but it is a significant issue, and there are two people in the audience. If there's anyone who would, three people in the audience, if there's anyone who would like to come forward and comment on this item, be an opportunity to do so.
Good evening again. I'm Chuck Fellows. I live on Canyon Way in Arroyo Grande. I'm on the City Planning Commission, and I'm also chairman of Preserve the Village. I always want to change what I've written to say after I hear you ruminate on these sort of things. You give me heartburn, but I'm going to stick to the script. All of us seem to understand, or at least we've given great lip service, to the value of preserving the charm and the character of our historic areas, that is, our village. Now you have an opportunity to do something concrete about it. There are a number of things that contribute to making the village a great tourist draw and a nice place for us and our families to visit, eat, buy a gift, a bottle of wine, some fresh produce, and so on. Two of the attributes, and one of these I think in your conversation you seem to just gloss over, two of the attributes that make the village a great place is the family-owned businesses, and almost every business in this village, outside of the fact of the stucco monstrosity of the village center, all family-owned. I could name just about every family that runs these businesses and owns the businesses. And that's what contributes to the second factor, and that's the uniqueness of the village, the atmosphere of the village. I don't know about you, maybe one of you I've been talking to lately, but I don't know about most of you, but when Linda and I want to plan a trip out of town, we don't say we've got to go to a place that has a Gap, a Starbucks, a McDonald's, a Subway sandwich shop, and a Long's Drugs. And I don't think many other people do. I think they want to go someplace that's different and unique and has an atmosphere that's a real draw. And that's not only important to visitors, it's important to the rest of us that live here. They want to experience something different. I'm about as passionate about this as the mayor is about the Grand Avenue. So I'd like to encourage you to keep our village special by directing staff to prepare an ordinance amending Title 16, defining and regulating formula businesses, and I think they're the same as franchises and the same as chains. They all would be detrimental to the health of the village. By prohibiting formula businesses, and I don't mean just formula restaurants, but formula retail, in the village core downtown and the village mixed-use districts. I think if you keep it clear-cut like that, it won't be such a hard thing to enforce and to interpret later on. Just no formula businesses in the village. If you do keep formula businesses out of the village, we can still all have access to them any place else in town and any place else in Grover City, anywhere within a mile. We can find a McDonald's. We can find a Subway sandwich, a Quiznos. I love their sandwiches, but I would not want to see them in the village. And if we want something really good personal service, we want really good personal service that you can't get at a lot of formula businesses, and something special.
Everybody has, including me.
Okay,
well, why don't you go?
Okay. One of the things that is part of Attachment 1 is a line that says that they require the incoming chain not look or operate like any other branch in the country. And I think that's critical. I think that for me, the restriction on formula businesses should be such that they can operate somewhere in the city. I don't want to keep them out of the city of Arroyo Grande. I don't want to keep a non-formula business that wants to be here. I don't want our language to be so restrictive that it's going to prevent some non-formula businesses from being able to be in the village. And I think that it does go back to focusing on protecting the village, mixed-use district, and the village core downtown district. So for me, I'd like to see the ordinance spell out very clearly the limitations. I think we should limit any business that's going to look or operate the same as an identical other branch of that business from being within the village. I think we might want to. I think that's where I'd like to see this go. I'm not let people expand on that.
Okay, Councilmember Guthrie.
Well, I guess I'll first just respond to some of the comments that were made under the question section. I actually think that many of the franchise operators in today's world are, in fact, more than able to meet our architectural requirements, if you will, in the village. They have a lot of – they probably would do a better job of than many of our independent operators because they actually have quite a bit of experience at that. If you go to State Street in Santa Barbara, you can see where McDonald's, Taco Bell, I think everybody but Wendy's really has blended in there. So I think that that simply saying all they have to do is meet our aesthetic demands here in the village would still – most of the franchisers, if they wanted to be here, would find a way to meet those. I guess I'm real mixed on this because this really is kind of antithetical to all my business instincts that says as soon as you ban a certain class of operators, you're also not serving a significant class of users within our community. And if we were talking community-wide, there's absolutely no way I could support this. But since it is just in the village, and we do have a very unique situation here in the village, in that the way that it is set up today is, in fact, almost exclusively owner-operators, and it is very successful, then there's no particular reason that we would need to break that up because we can, in fact, offer these services other places. I'd be inclined to go with a more restrictive approach. I think I would hate to see us put ourselves in a position where we are on a case-by-case basis trying to determine, based on how somebody says they're going to operate as a franchisor, whether they're a fit or not. I think we would want to take a fairly strict approach so that the burden of proof was absolutely theirs that they were, in fact, not a formula. So I'd want probably the strictest definition possible because I'd hate to see us in a position where we are, particularly if we end up with or we start talking about competitive issues where maybe we're trying to protect one business in town from a particular franchise operator. So I'd be in favor of the stricter approaches, I think the approach that Carmel takes here, where they have a fairly strict definition of formula business. And move forward with that. And so I think that's where I'm at on this.
Okay. Thank you. Councilmember Arnold.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Well, I'm going to say you were more persuasive tonight, Chuck, than the mayor was, because I was leaning to more of a consolatory, I was willing to allow them. And I think that the point that you make and I think the point that Jim makes are very good, that I think we do have a lot of places where you can get everything else in this city. And so, therefore, this is a very unique spot. And the point that you make about when you travel, what do you look for? And I do that all the time. I mean, I don't travel for those unique things, but whenever I'm out traveling, I always say, no, we're not going to eat there because we can get that at home, and I want to eat somewhere local. And it's a way to experience the area. So I definitely agree completely that I think to stay on a safer ground, and I think that the point that that Jim also made as far as not doing this to single out one individual business that we're trying to protect, I started off with that, and I think we could get on some real slippery slope there. So I would rather just see that we do everything possible to preserve the charm of the village. So my inclination would be to go with the Solvang, which maybe Carmel's was similar, which is to basically say, I mean, the fact that they used the word village in their description was kind of perfect for us. That none. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Dickens.
Well, first of all, I think it's, I'm going to echo what everyone else is saying, that I wouldn't support anything that dealt with a citywide ordinance. I think that there's a place for all businesses within the city of Arroyo Grande. I think that the issue for me revolves specifically around the village, and the village has a very unique ambiance to it, an atmosphere that is cannot be reproduced, and it cannot be reproduced in any kind of a formula business, in my opinion. I think that it's the charm, and I don't use the definition of family-owned business. Because I know, for instance, the Burger King, the Prudential Real Estate, and Susie's Hallmark, they're all family-owned. So, and those are great places. And the people who own those are wonderful individuals. And yet, I just don't picture necessarily those being an asset objective. Or we could look at just prohibiting formula businesses, period. And I think that if I were to look at this as it is now, I'm trying to decide, you know, what would be the benefits of having some when we could have those formula businesses in other areas if we so chose. I'm not sure. I'd like to see the ordinance, but I'm leaning towards actually looking at just a strict prohibition, and I think that might be our best bet. I think we might get ourselves into a little bit of a pickle down the road when we have a very successful family-owned business in the village that actually becomes a chain. When Andrini's becomes a chain down the road because they're so successful, similar to San Luis Sourdough. That was a local business that went big time. Now that would be nice, and I guess we'll deal with that at that time. But I think for what we're dealing with this evening and giving staff direction, I would either go one of two ways, either looking at an ordinance that would prohibit formula businesses, period, within the village because of the uniqueness, the atmosphere, and the inability for those businesses to conform and to, provide for enhancement. But if not, we would certainly, the other thing I would look at would be certainly identifying those aspects of architecture, signage, business practices that are expected within the village and reinforce those through a formula business ordinance that would enhance, I think, and actually strengthen our village guidelines. So either way.
Okay. Well, let me start off by saying that I'm personally insulted with the comment that you made about Chuck Fellows being more compelling in his argument. If that were the case, Chuck, I should have used you when we were talking about auto parts. But I think we're all saying the same thing. Getting back to the comments that I was making earlier, you know, my goal is to prohibit them in the village core and village mixed use. However we get there, the concern here is if you look at least the ones that I've seen presented here, if you look at if you look at Arcata, if you look at Calistoga, Carmel by the Sea, Solvang, which I quoted earlier, I only read the bottom line here. It said, therefore, the City Council, I'll read it again, finds that in order to preserve the character of the village, it is reasonable and necessary to adopt this ordinance, which would preclude the development of new formula restaurants in the village. If you look at all of those bottom line statements, you find that even though we don't have the complete ordinances here, somewhere in their ordinance, they have a justification for doing that. And the justification for that restriction backs into all of the things that we've been discussing that are those dicey potentials of, you know, somebody finding a loophole in. So my sense is that we can't come to a bottom line restriction like that on. And that's why you all get paid the big bucks, so that you can do that. So, with that, I'm certainly ready to support again an ordinance that will, in fact, give us that bottom line outcome with some very solid foundation upon which to base it. So I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I move that we direct staff to come back to us with language for an ordinance restricting formula businesses from the village and showing us some specific language in terms of definitions of formula businesses and the different options available to us to restrict their access to the village.
I'll second that.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. Okay. We're going to hurry on to item 12, City Council Reports. Just a few comments on SLOCOG. The last meeting we did get into, I guess, several personnel labor issues in closed session. A couple of other items that I forgot to mention at the previous report. First of all, Steve, I think I mentioned to you and I may have mentioned to the council that there was some optimistic news that with regard to some TEA money. And I'd mentioned it to Steve that SLOCOG is accepting projects from member agencies for TEA that fall within the TEA category, and it's essentially enhancement projects. It's not resurfacing or pavement or any of that. It's things like crosswalks and I think sidewalks and those kinds of projects. So it certainly would be in our best interest to start moving along, and I'm sure you've given the word to Don to get our priorities out there.
Yeah, actually, we've been working pretty hard this week on applications. We're trying to submit an application for the next phase of the Creekside Walk, and then also we're trying to get an application together also for the streetscape plan in the village. That one's a little more difficult in terms of timing because we've got to get Caltrans approval, and it gets pretty complicated. But we also have another backfall position on another grant program coming up in the fall for that one. So we've got a few strategies going on for those two projects.
Specifically, the crosswalk issues, too, especially the lighted crosswalk that we've approved, might be a way in which we can expedite the financing for that. Since I last brought this up, there was even some more money that was brought to the table for this purpose. The other thing, positions of the people in the community, their responses to similar surveys done through the Places Project lends credibility to what we determined was the priority of the community as well. So, you know, things like preserving agriculture and all of the other things that we hold in high esteem were sort of validated through this process. South County Sanitation District, I went to one of the last two meetings. We continue to talk about issues associated with the Arroyo Grande Creek and Zone 1-1A. There's some interesting things developing there that are sort of beyond the scope of this discussion right now, but perhaps at a future time I can elaborate a little bit more on that. The sanitation plant itself is back operating normal within the boundaries. There was a bit of a bump in the road when the rains came, and we had several components of the sanitation district, the plant itself, that were down. And as a result of that, we exceeded some of our limitations. And fortunately, we had a good track record with regional water quality, so they gave us a pass, which is unusual. So anyhow, all systems are back online, and we're back within the regulations and the standards. Okay, that concludes my report. Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. The Zone 3 Water Advisory Board met last month, and the most significant thing we were talking about is that habitat conservation plan that has still not been adapted or adopted by NOAA. And there was some proposal that we go forward with it and just initiate it. However, that seems to not be the thing to do. We need to get the attorneys on board, make sure that we have all our ducks in a row first before doing this, and that we really do need to get NOAA's buy-in on this. So that hopefully is going to go forward. But at this point, that means we're putting a lot of water down the creek for the habitat conservation plan that we might not necessarily need to be doing. Hopefully we can get some sort of agreement on that. I have no report from the RAC meeting. APCD did not meet. And I do have a report from the Fire Oversight Committee. We met a couple of weeks ago. Everything is going well. We're targeting getting some sort of joint dispatch service working, and that may be coming in July 1. Pismo Beach continues to request the potential for studying coming in with us and expanding what we're doing with Grover Beach. But that looks to be a ways off. They're willing to fund a study, but that study looks to have been to be going to be done by CDF. There's some question as to whether that will be completely independent, so we'll have to wait and see.
Approving a budget, and I think that pretty much covers most of the issues. The South County Youth Coalition meeting is this Thursday, so I do not have a report there.
Thank you. Councilmember Guthrie.
I did miss the last EVC meeting, although according to the minutes, apparently so did a lot of other people because they didn't have a quorum. They changed the date of it. But moving forward at this point, we are still without an executive director. My understanding is they're going to come up with an interim executive director to get us by here while they change their search pattern. They've made several offers and have been turned down several times. So the next meeting of EVC is tomorrow, so I'll certainly be attending that meeting.
Thank you. Councilmember Arnold.
Thank you. Integrated Waste Management Board meets next month. We're actually having lunch at the dump, which is a hot ticket to come by. And then I'm scheduled to attend training for the Joint Powers Insurance Authority in June down south. That's all I have.
Okay.
Lunch at the dump. It was a popular one.
All right, that takes us to item 13, City Council Member items. We have one this evening. Council Member Guthrie.
Yes, I think due to some disagreement between staff and particularly with Planning Commission as to an interpretation of ag element AG1, I'd like to see us as a council take a look at that sometime in the near future.
Can you be a little more specific as to the issue with the interpretation? What is it that you want to bring back?
Well, I'd like to take a look at. I think there's the misunderstanding is some inconsistency between the definition of ag land on prime soils that is designated that wasn't designated agricultural lands, that wasn't zoned agricultural lands, as opposed to. Prime soil sitting on land that is currently designated residential.
You said the same thing. You mean one is prime soils that are designated as ag, one is prime soils that are designated as residential.
Right, and whether there is a difference between those two in the way that the general plan looks at them.
Okay.
Thanks.
Anybody have any problems with bringing this back for discussion?
No, I
bring it back.
Yeah, I think that's something that's going to come forward, so if we bring it back ahead of time.
Okay.
Mr. Mayor, my only request would be that when it's brought back, that it's not connected to any specific project, that we're looking at just the policy issue in and of itself.
That's a good point, so all of us can sit here and chew on it. I agree. Okay, so it will come back, and we'll unwrap it. That takes us to item 14, city manager items. Anything tonight, Steve?
Nope.
Council communication? Any? Okay. Staff communication?
No, sir.
I think that's it. No, wait. I'm going to turn the page.
We have. We have. Item 17, community comments and suggestions. And you can talk about anything you want. I know. Colleen.
For the Planning Commission to be more specific also in their definition of what a neighborhood plan is and to decide what a neighborhood plan would very specifically include, whether it includes circulation, emergency services, routes, all those kind of things, what a neighborhood plan would be before a specific project would come before you that might have that type of definition. And lastly, I come before you to ask you to find a plan in the next year so you no longer have youth groups coming before you asking you for money. Tonight, you voted on a severance package for an employee, which I'm assuming you have eliminated that position, and at the same time gave a lot of money to a small group of children for a very specific cause. And I would venture to say, if we continue doing that, there's no reason that every group couldn't come before you and asking you for money. And whether that happens in a grant program as part of your annual budget, fine. But to be hit every other council meeting with a small little letter asking you for money for a specific plan seems like a poor way when, with that $2,000, I could build a sidewalk across from an elementary school. Or I could give that $2,000 as part of the pool project that would be benefiting lots of youth. So I think sometimes when we're giving money as a city, my money, your money, that we need to look at the umbrella of who we're benefiting. And just because we've set a precedence, and it's very difficult to say no when children are in front of you here at a televised meeting, that there should be a way to cut that off before it hits you. And so I ask you to look at that so that doesn't happen again. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, that takes us to motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Okay, we are adjourned. Thank you, gentlemen.